Hello and welcome to episode 38 of Realm and Ruin, a Warhammer podcast. A podcast that is so Warhammer that our microphones have a machine spirit. Who'd have thought? I'm your host, Matt, and joining me as always, a guy who is rumoured to have a beard made of green stuff and painted in contrast paint. It's Cameron. How you doing, mate?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you. Verily, I'm created whole cloth from various artistic products.
Yeah. And you're feeling okay now, because obviously it was a bit touch and go whether you were going to be here or not.
Yeah. So my microphone was possessed by a demon piece of scrap code very early this morning when I was attempting to be part of a recording for the Dark Insight podcast. I'm in that one for about 45 minutes total out of what's going to be like an hour and a half show. So, but the microphone's all fixed now. It's all good. I'm happy to still be here and not have to buy a new microphone.
I was sweating, mate, honestly. I was thinking it would feel odd you not being here. So thank you. Yeah. Thank you, you know, the machine spirit and maybe Nurgle for keeping you on board with us.
Maybe. We'll see.
Cool. Well, just throwing out here, it's another special episode. As promised for a little while now, we've now got another guest for us on this episode. So, and a returning guest, yes, another one. Someone else has decided to come back yet again for some reason, which is always a good sign. So returning to the show, it's Dan. How are you doing, mate?
I'm very well, thank you. I pray to the machine spirits this morning as well, to the Omnissiah. So my microphone is working too. And it's very good to be back.
Excellent. Yes, thank you very much for coming back. For people that may have not listened to that episode, because it's quite a while ago, because you were actually our first ever guest. So
it was almost a year ago, wasn't it? It was a while back.
Yeah. So can you tell people sort of who you are and what's your sort of Warhammer background?
I'm a very, very, very long-term hobbyist, probably for about 22 years. And I'm invested in this hobby, you know, in playing, painting, collecting, reading the books, and I just love it. I think ever since Star Wars started to decline in quality, this is my this is my favorite sci-fi.
Fair enough.
Yeah, that's a good show. Well, the thing is, so you're a bit of an all-rounder like us, you know, like you know the gaming, the collecting, the reading, and such like.
Yeah, so, absolutely. No. I wish I was doing more gaming. This last year has been quite difficult just because of family commitments, adult life getting in the way. but next year I'm planning to come back to gaming more so than this one.
Yeah, that's well. I think we all know where you're coming from that. It's, you know, we all got these aspirations of doing stuff, and I mean, to be fair, I think obviously Cameron, you've been quite hit and miss with your gaming on. You do get the odd game of things in, and to me, I managed to play AOS right in the last month after, you know, for the very first time. It's easy to sort of not, you know, not fit these things in when we're, you know, unfortunately we're adults and we can't play with our toy soldiers all the time, which is quite rude really, but that's the way life is. Cool. Right. Well, no, thank you very much for joining us, Dan. And Dan is joining us for the whole episode. So plenty of fun ahead. And talking of today's episode, what are we going to be talking about? So as always, we'll get stuck into the hobby section and what we've been working on and reading and everything like that. Then we'll obviously have our normal news section. Quite a bit to talk about in that. Some quite tasty stuff that's been around. And then for the main lore topic, we are going to discuss the lore and anything we find interesting from the Space Marines Codex at last. And then regarding a discussion topic, we'll put a question mark over it because there's more of us on this show today. We'll decide, you know, how we go in for time. So we may have a discussion topic at the end. We may not. So well, like I said, we'll make a call on it sort of later, but we'll see. We don't even know at this stage. And again, for clarity, just because something I'm going to try and do now, we're recording this on the 12th of October, 2019. So again, when we talk about news later, you know why we know stuff and maybe don't know other stuff. I'll quickly just go into a little bit of admin and then we'll crack on. So as of this recording, the bonus episode should be out. So basically we did a bonus episode the other week where we interviewed Davis Ford, the creator of AOS Reminders. So like I said, by the time you listen to this episode, that episode should already be out. So go check it out. He was a really cool guy, very interesting. And yeah, it's definitely worth a listen. And as always, if you want to see ways you can support the show, check us out on social media, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, just check the show notes for this particular episode. And obviously, you've got our lovely, gorgeous, sexy Discord server that Dan is now part of to be doing this recording.
I've just joined today.
Exactly, yeah. Fresh. Minty fresh on this one. So regarding the Discord server, as always, you're always free to join and come and chat to the lovely people on there. If you do, you can ask us a question and we can answer it on the show. And this is today's question. This comes from Pillar of the Community, Red Shadow. And he says, if you were all masters of your own Space Marine chapter, how would it wage war? So I'm going to ask that to you first, Dan, as our guest. So you're a master of your own chapter. How are you going to fight?
I'll tell you how I wouldn't fight. I wouldn't be sneaking around. I just think if you've got these 8-foot-tall battle tanks, you know, battle tank clad men, you just need to walk forward and destroy the enemy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's no arguing with that, really. So you wouldn't be like the Raven Guard, for example.
Definitely not like the Alpha Legion. I don't get those guys.
Yeah. So, that's fair enough. Well, I suppose adhering to the Codex Astartes, being a Ultramarine fan that you are?
Yes, I think I will. However, what's important is to keep in mind that Gilliman himself doesn't believe that you should follow it strictly to the letter in every situation. It's, you know, you have to adapt, overcome, that kind of thing. We've all seen the meme. I'm hoping that if I was actually a Space Marine commander, I would be a lot more intelligent than I am in real life. So I would have some incredible grand plan. But I just think follow the Codex.
Yeah. Yeah. Solid advice. How about yourself, Cameron?
So I had a quick think about this while Dan was talking, and I've come to only one proper conclusion, which is, what is the best transport vehicle in 40k? Answer, the Terrax Assault Drill. We will come from beneath.
Is that actually the best vehicle? Them.
Yeah, it's pretty damn good. I like the idea of, so Iron Warriors specialize in sieging, Imperial Fists specialize in fortifying, no one specializes in underground tunneling, and I feel the idea of the ground splitting open and a legion of Terminators just striding forwards out of this hole would be immensely satisfying and also very effective. You know, just get one guy with lightning claws in the front, he can keep digging. that's my off-the-cuff answer. My only other answer would be do it like I do in every playthrough of Skyrim, Stealth Archer. So just the exact opposite of what Dan wants. Yeah.
Cool. I like that. Okay, cool. Well, if I had to answer myself, I would... Well, my joke answer would be a big fan of the Emperor's Children, I would probably, I would probably break their confidence by saying how perfect I am. So I'll do it sort of psychologically and go, your power sword's not as big as my power sword and look how great it is. And then they just in shame turn away and I kill them. But no, my real answer would probably, do you know what? I'd probably be like the Night Lords. I would just go for terror tactics. I love that because I think that, one thing that people often forget when it comes to Space Marines is that they are a form of terror squad. And I don't mean just the Night Lords, but I mean in general, they are a quick, you know, they're not a slog type of force, which I know that often gets forgotten about. So, they get in, do the job, get out. And after reading a lot of the Night Lord stuff recently, as horrific as it can be, I just love the idea of, you know, these genetically enhanced super beings coming down, ripping stuff up literally and terrorizing the enemy so much that they just literally run away. I know that wouldn't apply to some forces. I don't think the Necrons would probably get that, for example. But, you know, but fundamentally, I just think, yeah, it's not probably the most efficient way, but I just find it would be the most entertaining way. And maybe that says more about me than anything else. I don't know. but, yeah, it's an interesting question, though. It depends. I suppose it depends how out there you want to be. You know, because you could just bombard them, you know, but that's a bit,
It's a difficult question. And I'm through my head now, I'm thinking about all the different chapters and how they fight. And you've got the Minotaurs who deploy as a whole chapter in every single fight. So they actually overwhelm you completely, which is very unique. Mm. And then you mentioned the Raven Guard as well, who would probably assassinate all the leadership before the fight even starts to make it as easy as possible. So I think, I don't know, it's really difficult.
It shows how many options they've got. And also, I love the variety of it anyway. I like the fact that I'm sure we'll get onto that when we talk about the Codex a bit later, where some of the successor chapters have got their own ways of fighting that isn't just the norm. So there is plenty out there. And also, how many adhere to the Codex? Because there's still quite a lot that completely shun it. There's some that, completely adhere to it. And there's obviously everything in between. It's quite a big spectrum out there. So, which is quite interesting. Okay. No, I like that. It's a good question. Thank you, Red. Very good one indeed. Right. Okay. Let's get on with the hobby section. And like I said, we'll start with yourself, Dan, as our guest. In general, recently, what have you been working on from a building, reading, et cetera, point of view?
Quite a bit, actually. I've built up a full AdMech army, led by Belisarius Corps, so it's a Mars faction. Mm. And I'll be adding some of the new tanks they released a couple of months back to it. That's got to be my next purchase for this army. I've also built up a bunch of knights, including a Castellan, which, even though it's not as popular now to be used following some rule changes, it's still, I think it's still an incredible model. It looks absolutely fantastic on the tabletop, and I love to use it as much as I can. And also, I've been building up my Space Marines, obviously with the new Codex, lots of new releases. So I've been adding all the new units. I think I've got 4,500 points now of pure Primaris Marines, which is which is on top of my 10,000 points of traditional Marines as well. So it's all fully painted. It's all ready to play. So I always love to add to the Marines. And also I've been reading, I've been listening to lots of audiobooks, from the Black Library, and I've just finished, Called a Great Work, which, I think this is one of the best 40k fictions that I've ever listened to. And I've been reading them since the good old days of Eisenhorn, that was written by Dan Abnett. So a long, long time. This was such a great story with such a unique feel to it. It felt so science fiction, because if you read something like The Lords of Silence, which is another book I just recently finished.
Yeah.
It's obviously full of magic. It's focusing on the Nurgle demons, the warp, and it's almost like sci fantasy. That's the real vibe you get of the book. Mm-hmm. Whereas the core book was very much ancient alien races, forbidden technologies, amazing scientific achievements. And it was a completely different feel. And this is why I love the 40K universe so much, because you can have these completely different stories, with completely different characters, following completely different sets of rules, but the universe allows them to exist side by side. And it's fantastic.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny you say about it, because I'm going to talk about it shortly because I've listened to it too.
Yeah, fantastic.
And it's so good that I think it wasn't like Cameron. I was like, Cameron, we must talk about this book.
Yeah.
so we're going to actually probably cover it as one of our main topics.
Should do it. I think it's mandatory reading for anyone who has any remote investment in 40K stories and lore. I think it's fantastic.
Totally agree with that.
there we go. So I'll have to get it now.
Yeah, honestly, it's again, we won't spoil anything because again, I think we'll save it for when we actually, A, so you can read it, but B, obviously, so we can cover it properly because I think we're going to cover it before the end of the year. I think it's sometime in November. And yeah, I like you, Dan, I had exactly the same. It feels so different. There's so many things going on. It reveals so much, because I was reading some comments of what people say obviously about the book, and some people are like, oh, you know, it's okay, it didn't really show that much. And I'm like, no, really, there's some very key points that you learn.
No, every single chapter had a stupendous revelation which like changes the outlook of the entire setting.
Exactly.
It was amazing,
it's one, you know, again, without spoiling anything, I think the one thing, and you may agree with me, Dan, is that it was one of those sort of books where you it reveals so many things. Because compared to some of the books that, because you're like, sort of reining it back, some books you read and they end up being like, that was a good book, enjoyable, you know, good action scenes, good dialogue. But, you know, from a lore perspective, nothing really changes. But obviously that wasn't the point of the, you know, a particular book. With The Great Work, it's one of those where if you're into the timeline, you've read Dark Imperium, Plague War, Devastation of Baal, etc. You know what's going on at the moment. And obviously you've looked into like Vigilus, for example, and things like that. This is one of those books you're like, you must read it. You know, it's almost like you said, Dan, it's like you have to, not just from the pure enjoyment, but if you really care about the lore and the way things are going, you need to find out, you know, there's the things you find out about Kaul himself, or which version, etc. You know, and what you find out about the Primaris Marines, it asks a lot of questions of yourself as well. So yeah,
it really fills some holes as well. I know people have some reservation in regards to the new lore, but I think this is where these Black Library books step in, and in this particular one, it really feels like it's moving the story forward. And that everything you find out in the book and every event that takes place in this book actually matters to the greater universe of 40K. Whereas in the past, you know, you might read some book about some random crusade or a big war on some planets. And at the end of the day, you know, nothing's actually changed about the setting, whereas this book is moving things forward. But in a very pleasing way. People shouldn't worry about it in this kind of sense. It's very good.
Yeah. Yeah, I would totally echo your thoughts on that, Dan. That's a good way of looking at it. So, Cameron, get on it, mate.
All right. Noted.
You've been told you must read this book. what was your thoughts on Lords of Silence, Dan?
Really good book. I felt quite sad towards the end for some of the characters. I'm not sure if I should spoil it for people because it is...
Keep it light.
It's a very, very good story. And as I said, it's a completely different feeling from the Belisarius Kaul book. It's almost like, you know, it's more like wizards and sorcery and like, you know, demons, obviously, in real space. And it's a very, very good story with some really interesting characters, some very sympathetic characters.
Yeah.
And also some very interesting charismatic leadership in the Death Guard, which you might not expect. We all know Typhus in Mortarion, but there's some really good characters in the Lords of Silence, which you end up liking as the book goes on, even though they're doing, you know, terrible things.
Yeah, that's a good way of summarizing it. Cameron, have you read it yet? I can't remember.
Yeah, I read it. Oh God, ages back. Actually, I think I read it right around when it came out. Yeah, no, anyways, I agree. It's a very good book.
Yeah, it is. And I think what I particularly like about it is because I remember reading this on Reddit recently. I think I was on the 40K lore one, and someone was saying as a topic that they were getting a bit tired of the whole Nurgle thing in general. Like, you know, from a lore and a book perspective where, you know, you're reading a book. Yeah. How many times can I read the word pus and things like that? You know, it gets a bit laborious. And mainly they were sort of aiming at some of the older books. They were also aiming at some of the newer books like Plague War and obviously, the Buried Dagger, the heresy one that we spoke about before. But a lot of people were recommending Lords of Silence as an alternative way to, you know, get into Nurgle. So if you're getting a bit tired of Nurgle, and you're like, I don't want to stop. I want to stop reading about this. Is that Lords of Silence, because of how well written it is, and because, like Dan said, the way they come across, that you almost sympathise some of them. It's actually quite. It can almost bring you back around, I think, when it comes to Nurgle. You know, I think that if you're sort of in between on them, it's a good way. It's a good representation of them. You know, you see them in. Well, I did anyway. You see them in a slightly different light, I think, as well.
Yeah, I think it's about the point of view as well, because you mentioned Plague War, which I think is a great book. The Dark Imperium series, again, I think a mandatory reading for any fans of the setting. But really in Dark Imperium, you see the Nurgle attack from the point of view of the Loyalists, and it's about how they react to these like disgusting monstrosities. Whereas in Plague War, it's mainly from the point of view of the actual Death Guard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're not disgusted by each other, so they don't really dwell on the pus and the disgusting goop and all that kind of thing. And it's just more about the characters, and it's a great, great book.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. What do they call the Nurglings again? Is it Little Lords?
Little Lords.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good. Cool. So have you anything else you've been reading or working on?
I've gone through quite a few Black Library books. I also went through Celestine, which I didn't enjoy quite as much. It was a slow paced book, and there wasn't really you kind of it focuses on how she gets resurrected after she's killed in battle, but it still doesn't really answer that many questions. Even though you actually watch her entire journey from the warp back to real space.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't recommend that one quite as much. And I also recently finished Knights of Macragge as well, which started out, I'll be very vague on it. It started out as almost like a horror haunted house kind of book. It's about a ship trapped in the warp and they're running out of energy. They're running out of power. They've been in the warp for 5 years and there's some scary stuff happening on the ship. And I thought, okay, it's one of these stories. I get it. But then about, I don't know, a third of the way through the book, it completely changes tone, setting, and it becomes this very, very interesting sci-fi set in a Bronze Age kind of like backward world, and it's very, very interesting. So I do recommend this book as well, actually. It's quite good.
It's funny you say that, because I've said on the show the last couple of episodes, it's one of the books I struggled to get through, and I actually gave up on it. And part of me wishes I hadn't. And I think, to be honest, I mean, I was listening to the audiobook, so I promised myself I'll probably pick up the paperback when it comes out and maybe have another go at it. Because I think the problem I faced with it is I didn't get, and probably bad on me, is I didn't get to that point that you were talking about where I know, because from what I read, without spoiling it for myself, it does flip. And I was still knee deep in the horror side, which I just found, I don't know, I just didn't really get into it. There's nothing really fundamentally wrong. I think also it was just something that I just didn't really click with. And you know, it was one of those where I think I tried, and I said on the show, I think I tried two or three times to try and read it. I'd get so far, go, no, right, I'll start again. And it, you know, maybe I should have just persevered, really.
Yeah, but you are right. The kind of the opening segments, the way the book starts, it kind of lingers in that part of the book for a long time before it changes kind of the setting and what's happening with the story. And eventually there's some really interesting revelations and some very, very interesting like plot twists. I was generally surprised by the end of what actually took place and transpired. But yeah, it's very slow to start, I think. But in a way, it makes the payoff better.
Yeah. Okay. That's good to know. Okay. No, like I said, I will give it another chance, because I don't like not finishing these books, because it feels like there's something like it's a gap that you aren't filling, really. But then sometimes, you know, you will find a book that you don't really get on with. I mean, I think, to be fair, and probably Cameron would agree with me, that most of the books we end up either covering on the show or reading in general, we're always really impressed with. It's very rare you're not impressed with the book, or at worst, it's average. I think in the, you know, sort of almost couple of years we've been doing this, I think the only books I can think of off the top of my head that I've really not been impressed with was Black Talon, which is the one of the AOS books, but I just didn't really click with it. But I think that's about it, really. I think apart from Knights from a Crag, and maybe I've just not given it a fair, you know, crack of the whip. I mean, Cameron, is there any books for you that you've sort of not been overly impressed with?
Off the top of my head, I don't think so, but I've read a lot of books over the last 2 years that I've been back in the hobby, so I'm sure there's one or two I wasn't as stoked about, but in general, yeah, I'm pretty happy with the overall quality of Black Library recently. Mm.
Yeah, no, definitely. Cool. Okay, before I move on to cameras, anything else, Dan, you wanted to say?
Yeah, I just think... like I said, there's a lot of people who are unhappy with the current state of 40k lore, and I think for many of these people, the only experience they have of the stories is the Codex and maybe the rulebook. But the Black Library books in particular, the ones coming out now, especially the series by Guy Haley, like Devastation of Bao, the Dark Imperium books, and now the Call book, I think it's actually some of the best 40k fiction we've ever had. And I think people really need to give them a shot. And I know some people don't like Primaris or the replacing classic Marines, but it does it does create some very interesting conflict and drama in the actual stories. So I think the fiction is of a very, very high quality at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I personally think that it's we're in a situation now, it almost feels a bit like what they've done with AOS, because obviously AOS sort of, you know, tore everything up, and then obviously it was received in a very mixed way, you know, and again, I'm talking primarily from a lore perspective, and, you know, now it's sort of finding its feet. People, you know, they're starting to work on the thing. So, right, you know, at first it was, and here's some Stormcast, and they're the Marines of AOS, and people are like, oh, okay, and some people love it. And then obviously now we're in, you know, from an AOS perspective, we're getting in a really good place. And I think with eight, you know, what happened from the, like, the Gathering Storm, and obviously now the Great Rift, I think again it felt, well, personally felt like the Gathering Storm was a bit of a rush, and like, and Gilliman's alive, and then all these new Marines turn up, and then I think now they've sort of got that out there, they're now filling in the blanks, filling in the gaps, and sort of now that base layer is sort of there, they're now, like you said, they're actually adding the really interesting bits. Like I said, that you know, I think it's same when we've discussed about the Stormcast, you know, people roll their eyes sometimes when you talk about them because of them being the poster boys like they do with the Primaris now. But fundamentally, there's a lot to them once you dig deep, you know, with excusing the cliche. And it's the same with Primaris. You know, Primaris, people are, oh, they're just bigger Marines, you know, and that's about it. But no, there's actually a lot more to them. And like I said, the conflict that they're sort of experiencing with, the older type Marines, the firstborn, as they keep getting referred to now, you know, it's things like that. And like I said, they can go wherever they want with it now. And I think we'll see much more interesting stuff come through. So no, I would agree with that, with you on that. So yeah, we'll see. We'll see where it goes. Cool. Right. Cameron, what you've been working on, mate? I know you've been working on something very nurgly.
Yes. So last episode I mentioned that it's the school holidays and I might have time to finally actually do some proper hobbying, and I did, which is great. So effectively I've finished, my Night Desecrator. It's all painted. It's all complete. It's on display in the Joondalup Warhammer store. If you're in Perth, go have a look at it. And the second I finished it, I fell dreadfully ill. A blessing was bestowed upon me. and in your sort reward. Of some kind of, yeah, exactly. In some kind of mucus fueled fever dream, over 4 days, I completed the second, war dog I was talking about, the one with a pox walker for a pilot who was sort of trying to, like, break his chains and escape the cockpit to actually, you know, scramble onto the battlefield and eat some brains himself. That is also now, as of this morning, 100% complete. You know, all the extra detailing, all the transfers and stuff, all done. And I can only say that apparently being sick is really good for my productivity. I guess if, you know, I don't have the mental energy to focus on more than one thing, I just do that one thing for a whole day. I don't remember most of the 4 days I was sick. But it worked. so I won't complain. yeah, so now I have three, I guess it's 2.5 completed nights, technically. I don't think an Arbiter counts for a full one, especially because I built it in a week and I painted it in a day and a half, effectively, as opposed to a night, which can take a month and a bit to build and the same to paint. So, but I feel I found my groove with this particular style for my custom night household, House Interitis. And so the three of them are all together. They're all sitting in a cabinet with some extra Poxwalkers at the Jude Love Warhammer store, because they're going to stay there just for a bit longer, because I realized that Saturday next week, so probably shortly after this comes out, it is Armies on Parade, and I've never done an Armies on Parade, and it seems like very few people at my local store are planning to do an Armies on Parade, and I feel that's a little sad. So I'm doing Armies on Parade next week, which means I have 4 days before I go back to work to build a board to put them all on. So it's not going to be highly detailed. It's going to be a bit of a slap job, but I feel that suits the Nurgle aesthetic, so it's all good. at the moment, I found my old PS4, like the box it came in the back of my cupboard. So I took that box and I've slashed it to ribbons to build the board effectively. So there's cardboard all over the house. It's all in pieces all over the place. It's an awful mess, but I'm having fun. I've sort of set up 2 layers, so I've cut out where the bases are going to go so they can sort of sink with some weight and swampiness into the base. And it's just going to be destroyed buildings, mud and rivers of slime everywhere. I'm tempted, we'll see if I have time, to paint up some of my Imperial Guardsmen I made for Kilteam, and have them as sort of points of interest scattered around the edges of the board, sort of fighting off. Like, I've got, I forget what his name was, but he's Grenades McGee, my guy, my guardsman holding a grenade in either hand because he's so happy to be able to have grenades. So I think I'm just going to put him, if I have time to paint him up, I'll put him in the middle of the Poxwalker mob with all of them like facing him. So it's like, you know, the zombie apocalypse moment, pull the pins for the Emperor. yeah, get some of that grim dark futility going on, because yeah, he's going to take out between 5 and 10 Poxwalkers, but there's also 2 full blown Chaos Knights and a Chaos War Dog just looking at him from over the ruins of a building just over there. So yeah, he's doing his best, but his best isn't good enough in the grand scheme of thing, which I feel is wonderfully thematic. I've done some extra green stuff work on the first Armiger I started working on. That is still ready to be primed and painted, but I'm going to have to build the weapons for it because I kind of took the weapons from that and stuck them on the second Armiger instead. So that'll happen not this week, because this week I need to focus on building a board, but it'll happen soon. My brain is clicking over, making sure I'm not forgetting things. Look, it's difficult. But this means I have about bang on 1,000 points of Chaos Knights. It's 2 knights and an Armiger, but it's technically a force. I'm not going to bring it to a 1,000 point game because I feel that would be rude. but, you know, it's there. It's there. It's something I have. It's something I can sort of splice into my Death Guard from, you know, time to time now if I actually get back into playing 40k. We'll see about that. But yes, in my time that I wasn't feverishly ill, I played a game of Beastgrave with my partner Erin. It was her first ever game of Warhammer Underworld, so we played with open hands so I could sort of, you know, explain card texts to her that she didn't understand and stuff like that, and she beat the absolute snot out of me. I lost that one. I lost 11-3. Which was ridiculous.
No, like, this is good. She's supposed to win the first game. This is good.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, I feel like it's a thing, though, because the first time she played Kill Team, she also beat the absolute living daylights out of me with the Death Guard Kill Team that I wrote up for her really quickly. So I don't know if she's really, really good at games, or she just has some insane quantum probability field that means I can't roll for shit and she can roll really well while we're actively competing against each other. But yeah, it was really fun. Warhammer Underworlds continues to be extremely good. And there are some really cool cards and ploys that you can play in the new one. My favorite one, I played the Beastman team. My favorite ploy is Berserk Bellow, which is you push everyone next to you back one, and then you push them each back another hex for every wound you've taken.
Okay.
So my desperate last gambit to get some goddamn points in that game was taking my leader, the Bray Shaman, sprinting him across the board to an objective in the back of Eren's territory. And then when they all came in to attack him, he just went, ah, and they all got pushed back five spaces because of how much, four or five spaces because of how much damage he'd taken. But unfortunately, they still managed to shoot him off. And it turned out I'd forgotten her final objective was kill someone standing on an objective counter. So that netted her a bunch of extra points. I wasn't going to win. But in the heat of the moment, I forgot to play tactically. So I never claim to be good at these games, but at least I'm having fun.
would you say you lost heroically?
It was a heroic last ditch effort. I would pay that out. I would say I cunningly sacrificed all of my Ungor in the first two rounds. Absolutely, 100% used them to the best of their ability and didn't waste them at all. Totally. but yeah, it's a really good game. I'm gonna have to pick up the Grimwatch sometime soon now that they're out. But apart from that, I think that was most of what I did was painting two very big models and then playing a quick game of Underworlds. But you know, it's been really fun. It's good. And hopefully next time I can talk about how I managed to somehow build an armies on parade board in 4 days.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Out of cardboard and spit.
The Nurgle way. That sounds good. So yeah, you had some fun and you kept your relationship intact. That's good.
Yeah, I like exactly.
Cool. Okay. Nice one. Right. Right. What have I been doing? It sort of feels like I've been doing a lot of buying, if that counts for anything. I've been also getting on that Beast Grave train. So my copy arrived recently. Started delving through it and I've done a lot of card sorting out, really, because I've been moving, and all my cards from the previous versions like Night Vault and Shadespire were sort of hanging around, so I had a bit of a tidy up of them, and obviously that's quite therapeutic in its own way. So I've got Beast Grave, I've got Power Unbound, which is the Night Vault expansion. My mate Martin, obviously, who I work with, he's also got Beast Grave as well coming any point. So yeah, we're going to play a bit of that soon. So I'll be hopefully regularly playing that. I also grabbed the AOS gaming book. Oh, it's lovely. It's so diddy. It's so cute. You know, it's one of those things where I was like, wow, I really didn't realize how small this is. And it's a really handy little book, to be fair. I mean, like I said, you get the core rules, you get things like, you get all the battle plans from, well, like the 2019, the 2018 ones, so the things that would show in General's Handbook. You also get like the Malign Sorcery side of things, like the artifacts and also the battle plans from that. You know, get also the Grand Alliance allegiance abilities and all that. So it's a nice little book. Like I said, it's one of those where when you see it on the website, it's actually a lot smaller. It is about A5 size, even though sometimes in the photos it doesn't look it. But yeah, it's all lovely, handy little book. Yesterday I picked up the Cities of Sigmar battle tome. Because I just want to really, I'm just really looking forward to reading about it. And this is the problem that because obviously I work with my mate Martin, and therefore most of the day when we're not working, we can talk about Warhammer. We just talk about, you know, stuff and we're our own worst enemies, because you end up inspiring each other. Like recently, he's been talking about getting into Caradhron Overlords. So the next day, I just put the battle tome on his work desk, and he's like, "No, Matt, no, stop tempting me." And then, then before you know it, 2,000 points has been planned. So we were doing, like yesterday at work, we were doing a lot of Cities of Sigmar theory crafting, as in, like, you know, what abilities work with certain units, and yeah, it looks very interesting. And also I bought it because I'm going on holiday next week, so it's going to be one of the things I want to read through. I also picked up, again talking about like Underworlds and such like, I picked up the Sylvaneth Warband, the Atari's Guardians, or however you pronounce it.
Yeah.
So they're very, they're models where you don't want to sneeze if you were building them. Let's say that. They look very flimsy or very intricate. So I'm going to be a bit careful when I put those together. So, and I'm hoping as well, similar to what you did with Erin, I'm hoping I'll get my wife into playing Underworlds as well, because she quite likes card games, but she's not really into model games. So I'm hoping it'll bridge that bridge that gap. And actually, talking to Sylvaneth, I had a just a bit of a hobby want, Rich, really, which was to try and build my own Arch Revenant, which is obviously the character that's still not been released from Loon Curse. So I my plan was to take one of the tree revenants, which is the Scion, so the, you know, the sort of captain type one. And so I picked him. He already comes with a glaive. I then got, because I've got a box of Wild Riders, randomly, I sort of took the head of one of those, which looks very similar to the Revenant mask. And then my plan was to put a shield on their back. And I've put it together, but I'm not happy with it, if I'm being brutally honest. It's not quite, the problem is there's too many branches getting in the way. So like the head won't sit right. And you know, when you sort of think, you know what, this really hasn't gone the way I wanted it to. So, I may start again on it, to be honest. You know, it's one of those experiments where it's not really going to be a big problem. I got some Kinnerai wings for it as well, you know, off the Kinnerai, was it Heartseekers, the, you know, the Daughters of Cain stuff. So yeah, I'm just going to see how it goes, but I'm not, you know, when you have an idea in your head and it doesn't come to plan, it's one of those situations. So I'm going to probably go back to the drawing board on that. I'm not entirely happy, but yeah, I that's only really thing I've been doing hobby wise. Cause ultimately it's the last 2 weeks have just disappeared. A bit like you, where I don't really remember what's happened. So my plan, though, is when I go away next week, because it's going to be quite a chilled little break with the family, I've got a box of Custodes to take away with me, and my plan is to at least build those as and when I can, because obviously I'm playing at Warhammer World with some of our guys from our Discord, so I need to get my Custodes built and ready. So that'll be my plan. And from a reading perspective, obviously we spoke about The Great Work. It's a great book. I also listened to Beast Grave, the novel, which is okay. It's not bad. I would say it's without sort of being derogatory to it, it's a bit of a filler novel. It's one of those where there's a bit of action, you know, it's basically a Sylvaneth versus Beast of Chaos situation. It does give a bit of lore regarding Beastgrave, the mountain itself, but it's okay. Like you said, it's definitely worth a read, but I wouldn't rush to read it. It's not like The Great Work, for example. And also, I've also started The Tainted Heart, which is another AOS book that is to do with witch hunters. It's that one where you got that the man and woman team on the front cover. And it was good. I'm a couple of chapters in, and it's, so far, to be fair, you wouldn't even think it was an AOS novel so far. It's been very sort of, you know, that sort of generic lore where, you know, you could be reading any fantasy book, but I'm sure things will start happening. So, yeah, that's something I'll be reading next week. Excellent. I think that's been it from a hobby perspective. Hopefully a bit more to talk about in a couple of weeks' time. Right, okay, so we've all had our go at it. So I think what we'll do now is we will take our first little break, and then when we return, as always, we'll talk about all that lovely Warhammer news. Back soon. Right. Time for the news, and as always, we'll get stuck into the 40k stuff first. So for people that listened to the last episode, we were on the verge of the reveal of what we believed was going to be Drazhar, and guess what, it was.
We're right.
We never saw that coming. So yes, as now revealed, Drazhar has been the next character to be revealed, along with the now box set as well. So, but we'll talk about Drazhar as well. So, so Dan, what are you thinking of this new model for him? Are you liking it or not?
I like the model, and I really like the character. I'm a big fan of Incubi in general. I think they're one of the coolest melee units in the game, visually, and the way they play as well is very. They kind of like. They're not hard to kill, but they can kill anything else as well, which I really like. And rules-wise, he seems very solid as well. He has that plus one to wound aura for incubi around him, which is very, very strong.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think if
Master of Blades.
Yeah, if people have an interest in the model, in the character, I think he's perfectly viable now for any kind of list, so he's great.
Yeah. Yeah, he's... what's your take on it, Cameron?
I think he's pretty cool. I'm not sure, for me personally, if he stands out from a standard incubi enough, like in basic design. I feel like... I mean, to be fair, he is the original incubi, so it makes sense he looks just like an incubi, but... I don't know, man. Give him something a little more dramatic, maybe. But you know, that's personal taste. I like capes and big hair, and this model doesn't have that.
What about your models?
But you know. Otherwise, I think he's really well done. We got another HQ standing out by standing on top of some rocks, which honestly, I'm all for, just because they're so hard to pick out. Otherwise, he looks really cool. Like Dan said, he's probably going to be pretty damn good if you try and build like a fast melee-focused Dark Eldar list, because a bunch of incubi with plus one to wound stands a decent chance of carving pretty much anything in the game apart, honestly.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And, I mean, you've got, obviously, his murderous assault, which means if model made a charge move this turn, he can choose to fight this model additional time. He's got a five plus involved by the look of it as well. So, yeah, no,
that ability to fight twice is really good. I mean, to put it in terms that people can kind of compare, in the Marine Codex, it will cost you 3 command points to fight a second time. This guy gets that for free.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, so if he does it twice in a game, that would have cost a different player 6 command points.
And
Dark Eldar, they're not exactly, their units are cheap, so their vehicles are cheap, their infantry is cheap.
Yes.
So you can easily throw this guy into an army with a good number of incubi in a transport and not sacrifice much of the rest of the army in terms of shooting, mobility, board control. So I think he's a strong choice.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'd also agree with you, Cameron. I think as a model, he's lovely. He's a good model, but yeah, does he stand out? Not overly, but then to be fair, I think with the Phoenix Lords, and it's obviously lore wise, is he a Phoenix Lord or not? It's one of those situations where I suppose they try to keep them as safe as they can regarding the aspect they're from. I mean, even if you look at Jayne Zarr, yeah, she does stand out compared to the Howling Banshees, but you can tell where she's from, and I think it's probably where they've gone with Drazhar as well. Like you said, maybe give him a cape or something else like that, but he's still a lovely model, to be fair. He stands out. He's in a good action pose that's obviously go against Jayne Zarr, which is obviously deliberate, no doubt. So, yeah, he's good. And to be fair, it's good that, like we said before, that Jakari are getting these sort of things and Xenos in general. So now I think it's really cool. And obviously, as I mentioned, we've now got up for pre-order as of today, the Blood of the Phoenix and Phoenix Rising part of this, which is, so Blood of the Phoenix is going to be the box set and Phoenix Rising is going to be the very first Psychic Awakening book to go alongside it. So as we were discussing before in the break, so over here in the UK, Blood of the Phoenix, £140. How much over there for you, Cameron?
$390 which, oof. Yeah, I'm glad I'm not an Eldar player. That's all I'll say there. This box is lovely. It's got great stuff in it. I am not touching it with a 10-foot pole.
But, Dan, you had a bit of a theory, didn't you, of why it may be costing that sort of much?
Yeah, I think we have to keep in mind that these are all full kits. These aren't snap-fit, easy-to-build kits like Shadow Spire or Dark Imperium. So the box will have more of a premium. That being said, some of the kits are quite old as well, so it's down to the individual if they feel there's a value there. I think it's a great box to actually split with someone. It becomes more kind of bearable this way. But if you are a new player starting a Dark Eldar or Eldar Army, these are fantastic models.
I'd agree with that. I mean, I think the price thing is a tricky one because, I mean, it depends how you break it down. Because this price was leaked earlier in the week, and obviously it's been confirmed obviously as of today because it's officially on the website. And me and Martin at work were sort of talking about it that, you know, realistically, you're probably going to maybe want to go halves on this with someone anyway and split the box. And, you know, realistically, if you're, say it was 140, say you then bought it from an indie store, which a lot of people do, it'll probably go down to about 120 or something like that, roughly, or maybe, you know, what in the teens, one teen. And then I think we worked out that realistically, then by the time you have it, you're talking about £56, something like £55, £56. And if you get into that sort of level, that's not far different to buying a start collecting box. And in reality, you're getting, especially on the Drakari side, you're getting quite a lot of there, quite a few models. You're getting the new Incubi, you're getting Drezar, you know, obviously with the Eldar side, you're getting obviously Jainzar and the new Hanan Banshees. And you're thinking, well, 50 odd quid, is that actually that bad? Not that bad, really, I don't think. You know, if you break it down to that sort of level, I suppose what we have to sort of see now is this going to become the trend now? Because, you know, obviously we saw it with Shadow Spear, where obviously it was a little bit more expensive than the previous boxes. You know, obviously this one's now quite a big jump in comparison. And, you know, is this now going to become the norm? Don't know. Or is this just a one-off because of what's in it?
There's still a saving.
So yes,
You're still saving money. And I think Dark Imperium specifically, it was such amazing value for the sheer number of models you get. And Shadowspire was you know, very, very good as well. I think maybe we've been spoiled, but this is expensive. I think as soon as you go over £100, and you just mentioned, you know, $390 as well.
Yeah.
I think it's just, it does look, it just feels more expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think in all honesty, I get why it's a little bit more expensive, but I think maybe if it was around the sort of 120 mark initially, you know, before you go to maybe an indie store and get it for cheaper, would have been a bit more acceptable. I think 140 is getting into that bit, you know, that realm where it's like, it's still, you know, I don't know. Price is a very subjective thing for people. So it's a very difficult thing to answer. Well, there is no answer really. You know, for some people it's expensive, some people it's a bargain. It really, you know, and now that'll make, it'll be really interesting to see how much that Sisters of Battle Army set is going to be when it's out. I'm guessing next month, you know, with the codex and things like that. Because I think what confused people was when they saw the 140, I think I saw some people online thought that the Phoenix Rising book that's also being released was part of that. You know, so you're paying 140, but you're getting the book as well. And then obviously you're not, which makes people think, oh, okay, it's not as much as I thought it was going to be. So, you know.
I mean, for the Sisters box, they've already confirmed these are all monopose, easy-to-build style models in that, apparently. Mm-hmm. So I would not be surprised if the Sisters box was around the same price, but it would also include a limited edition codex. So, you know, that really balances that out a lot in the terms of things. But we'll see in like a month or so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
On the other hand, Phoenix Rising, the book, looks pretty good.
Yeah.
Guess what? Hey, you know how Space Marines can completely customize their chapter tactics now? Guess what? So can Asuriani and Dark Eldar. So if you're a Craft Worlds or a Dark Eldar player, you can just build those Witch Covens, build those Craft World traits however you want out of, like, I think they said 20 to 30 options for the Craft World ones in particular. Yeah. It's the same system of pick two, and that's what you got, or you can pick one of the main Craft Worlds, obviously. I think they showed off one option where if you pick this, you don't get to pick another one because it was a particularly powerful one.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it is yet to be seen if, like, this mix and matching stands up to the actual standard craft world / cabal / coven / the homunculus thingamajig traits, but you know, we'll see. And even if they're not, like, honestly, that level of customization is always really fun. Like, it's my favorite thing, looking at the Space Marine Codex this last couple of weeks, is going, oh, you could do this and this, or that and that.
Dan, are you a fan of these sort of things where you can sort of customize them?
Oh, I think it's fantastic. Mm. And there's lots of players who focus more on theme and lore than they do on, you know, on the actual just what is the best combination of rules.
Mm,
mm. And I think if they're done well, I mean, I've not seen all the traits you can pick. If they're done well, they can be really, really good. And if it opens up some new avenues of playstyle as well, because Eldar in particular have become very much an army of, you know, on the tabletop in a competitive setting, they're spamming vehicles, they're spamming fighter jets.
Yeah.
If these new rules open up new avenues of play, everyone benefits. You know, people will be facing a better variety of lists. People who want to build a certain type of army might be able to do so. And I think, I think it's great. I think the Space Marine sets of rules were really good. If these are just as good, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. Mm? Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think, you know, because that's the thing people, you know, need to always remember is that not everything is what is the most meta. It's what's, you know, some people like their fluffy things, love having to be able to customize it. I mean, that's how a lot of people especially get into 40K, especially if you're into your Marines. You know, some people, the thought of creating your own chapter, both from a visual and a rules perspective, is what they want. It's their bread and butter. It gets them into the hobby. And I think doing it with other races is perfectly acceptable because, you know, because realistically most factions, whether it's, you know, 40K or AOS, is that ultimately there's, you know, their version of, you know, division amongst them, you know, in case of, you know, chapters, storm hosts, cabals, you know, whatever you want to, whatever it gets referred to, you know, and I think people appreciate that. I do. And it's just that nice that they're actually acknowledging that from actually a rules perspective. And you can sort of now pick and choose. We're now seeing it in the Cities of Sigmar Battletome where, you know, you go, right, okay, pick a city and pick all the units that you want to put under it, you know, and it's, you know, this wide range. That's great. You know, there's nothing wrong with having customization and flexibility. It's, you know, arguably that's what you want. Obviously, like I said, from a meta perspective, that can, you know, can sway things, and it depends, you know, obviously it's, and they obviously from their perspective they must get it into a very tight balance, because obviously things can be very OP or not. But no, it's very, very, very exciting. So right, okay, actually talking of sisters, as we were a minute ago, so the army box contents have been revealed now, and I think it's safe to say they're as expected. Do you think that's right?
Yeah.
They look
fucking fantastic. I'll give them that.
They look amazing. I think I'll be buying the box set. I've got Celestine and that limited edition 80s style Canoness.
Yeah, if you recall
the model, the one with the really cool hair.
Yeah.
I think Celestine is one of the best models in the game to look at. Mm. She's very dynamic, very, very impressive. So I think I'll probably buy the box set and I'll start making a sister's army. I think the models look absolutely fantastic.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, I was not expecting Arco Flagellants in the box for some reason, which looking back makes perfect sense. But boy, am I happy to see really good-looking Arco Flagellants. And a shout out to the old Inquisitor model line they were based off, because that flagellant, I think is Damien 44 or something from the Inquisitor game series, was so cool. Like that is still the epitome of like a grim dark Arco flagellant to me. And
yeah,
you know, it's directly citing
that. I'm very happy
really
about
good.
That as well, yeah. Mm. I think some people are concerned that the setting is becoming a bit more child friendly, maybe a little bit more kind of downplayed, and then you see those models, then you see like the sisters box set, and you have like these just like tortured people made into just like killing machines with just like whips kind of stuck onto stumpy limbs, and it's just and they look absolutely amazing. Yeah,
we're the good guys, don't forget.
Honest
quote unquote.
No, I mean, I think it's is an awesome looking set, and I think it's a lovely starter set anyway, and I think personally it's the perfect way that they could have they could introduce the sisters back, I think, as well. Mm. And also it just shows that, well, to me anyway, there's obviously going to be a further waves, you know, regarding this. Because obviously at this point, the army set is a canoness, 10 battle sisters, 5 seraphim, a repentia superior, 4 repentia, 3 of the flagellants, the penitent engine. And then you obviously get the limited or exclusive edition of the codex, data cards, dice, transfer sheet, and obviously the core rule book. I mean, that's a lovely starter set.
Like,
the monopose thing, I don't consider that a bad thing personally. I think it's like price, it's very subjective. As a time restricted adult, you know, monopose is great. It's like, yes, get them bashed together, get them on the tabletop. But let's be honest, they're realistic, they're going to probably create more, you know, dynamic posed kits later down the line, like you've seen with, you know, they've done obviously with Primaris, for example. I worked out the other day using Battlescribe, obviously using the old points or the current points, and I had to do a bit of tweaking because I think the Repentia Superior is not actually in there, but it was roughly about 400 points. Give or take.
Okay.
Again, that may swing, obviously, if they have a points update as part of the proper codex. But yeah, it's about 400 points. But then a bit like the Drakari, they're quite cheap anyway. They are cheap, you know, points wise. There are cheap units anyway, so that's to be expected. So yeah, I think very exciting times ahead, actually. And obviously, the side effect of this is obviously that all the metal stuff for Sisters of Battle is now gone last chance to buy. Is it still up now? I don't even know now.
Yes. Still there? They said they could guarantee it through till the 13th or 14th, I believe, and that they would run it for a week after that, but they would be almost definitely having shortages. So by the time you're listening to this, go see if there's any left. I mean, those old metal models are still lovely. They're still really great and characterful. They won't look too bad next to the new stuff, I reckon. So if you want to get a head start, I mean, go mosey on. If there's any left, there's probably none left, knowing this community.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, how quickly they disappear off the website is crazy at times. So no, I think they'll sell it all. I think it will literally all go because people want it for their collections and just as a bit of history, I suppose, as well. And they chuck it in with the new sisters. So very, very, very exciting.
So just checking it now, they all still seem to be up, but like I said, that won't last. So
yeah, get to they'll it. Be good. There we go. Cool. So yeah, that's all sisters. So the last bit of main 40k news is obviously the Bandai Intercessor. So Dan, did you get yourself one?
I've got mine pre-ordered.
Yes. I thought you would. Good for you. So what made you go for it? Just thought it'd be a nice centerpiece for your room.
I think. Some people were complaining about price. I think the price is absolutely fine. You know, it's in line with like other kind of collectible figurines that you see in kind of shops. It just looks really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's a big ultramarine.
And I'm not even sure if I'll take it out of the box when I get it. Yeah. But it just looks cool. So it's a no-brainer.
Yeah. Well, and you're obviously a massive ultramarines fan anyway, so... Again, I suppose, again, if, no brainer.
If they're a success, I imagine that they'll probably make other models. So, and by all accounts, it looks like it was a big success. They sold out in 2 days, didn't they? So,
it's
good.
Yeah, it's... I think, like you said, I think this sounds like an experiment of sorts, really, because obviously this is them working with another company, and obviously a very big company in Bandai, but obviously, you know, you can tell that GW are getting more braver at doing this sort of thing, you know, working with other companies, now big IPs. And obviously we're going to be talking about that later when we talk about Marvel. And they just want to sort of test the water. And I suppose Bandai do too as well, because I suppose this is always the thing when two big companies or big IPs and platforms get together, then there's always probably a little bit of apprehension because obviously you don't want to ruin your reputation as part of this. And, you know, for Bandai, I mean, obviously I'm sure they're aware that Warhammer and 40K and Games Workshop is a, you know, is a big brand, and there's no argument with that now these days, but still it's, you know, they're used to making their Gundams and things like that, which is their sort of, again, their thing. So this is a totally different experience for them. So, but no, it shows that they're obviously, like you said, there obviously was a demand for it. It's gone in a couple of days. I think it was good also that, it was actually, you did have a chance to get one, because like I actually went on the website, you know, to see how much they were. Just, I mean, I didn't get one in the end because I didn't feel like I need to buy one, but you know, I could actually get one. It's not like with the, you know, limited edition, Siege of Terror books where like the website crashes and you can't get it. It was actually, you know, you did have a reasonable chance to get one. So no, and like you said, Dan, I think the price was reasonable, actually. I don't, you know, it's, I know 70, again, price is always a funny subject, but 75, I think, you know, considering the size of it and the collectability of it, it could have been a lot more than that, to be honest. And I'm wondering, do you think it was Bandai that influenced that, potentially?
I'm not sure, right?
Yeah, the price, I meant, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, from what I can tell, it's pretty standard for that kind of scale and quality that they seem to be going for. So, like, this again, this is a limited run. They're doing this one set of, I think it was 9,000, and they're doing it in a specific time slot, and, like, it is a luxury item. It's a luxury item within a luxury hobby. Like,
yeah.
It's not, yeah. It's not surprising it's that expensive. It's a little sad I didn't end up getting one either, but, like, there will almost undoubtedly be more runs.
Yeah.
Like, I cannot imagine that they wouldn't do another one of these with a different chapter or do a Chaos one. I'll definitely get one of those.
Yeah. If not, I'll make one Chaos.
Well, yeah, there's always that possibility.
I wonder if the price in combination with the numbers they did was some sort of kind of, was like the limit they had to make before it's actually profitable.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Maybe.
I wonder what the margins are like actually on this figure. Is it hand painted or is it just machine painted? I'm not sure.
I presume it's machine, but no, don't know. Yeah, it could be
like stencil painted by individuals. I'm really not sure what the Bandai process is like. I think the numbers, it probably is just an experiment, and I think it's been a success. So we probably will see a bigger run in the future of a different figure.
Yeah, I think there's a very high chance of that. And I think what I liked about this, for better or worse, I liked the fact that they made a point of going, there is 9,000, that's it. You know, because, you know, the whole availability and limited nature of some of the things that we've seen over the last, X amount of time, again, is a bit of a contentious subject, you know, where people are missing out on stuff and it's, you know, people are just not getting a chance. I mean, I'd agree with some, you know, like we've seen it with some of the box sets like Loon Curse and Karen Empire, where they're literally gone before they even hit the shelves, and then that's it and it's gone. And, you know, as you see, other boxes are around for quite a while. So it depends whether this is GW realizing that's what they should do in the future, or again, whether this is Bandai saying, no, I want, you know, we want you to make a point that there is only 9,000, and, you know, it could be, or a combination of that. I think, you know, that's a good thing. I think I'd like to see more of that. You know, time limits. I don't like time limits, but if there's going to be a limit, you know, make it very, you know, broadcast it, say, you know, yes, you know, a bit like what you said about the sisters, Cameron, where it's like, right, you know, we'll guarantee it to this date for this long, but then once it's gone, it's gone. Whereas some of the other things, they've gone last chance to buy, no one's really known about it, and then like that's it, they've disappeared. Whereas at least like with the made to order stuff, you see where you go, right, you've got a week to buy it, and you know that's it, then at least, you know, it guarantees you to get it, then, you know, people can make decisions around that. Like I said, I just get a bit frustrated sometimes when you don't get a chance to buy it at all and it's gone before you've even heard about it. But this was I think they did a much better job of this, so that's really good. So I suppose, Dan, from your perspective, you'll be all of a sudden getting a mysterious package in about, what's it, 6 months time.
Yeah.
It's one of those things you end up forgetting about.
Yeah, I think it's funny you mentioned the price of this figure. I think we're in this hobby, So I look at £75 and I think, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's a very fair point, actually, because it's again, price is always a weird thing. You know, it's so hard to talk about it because, you know, you're right. For, you know, 75 in this hobby is nothing, but 75 can be a lot to a lot of people.
It's a lot of money. Yeah. It could be a weekly shop for someone, you know, mm-hmm. It could be like the food and the bills for someone, but yeah, you know, we have made the choice to be in this hobby. And,
yes.
I think from somebody in this hobby, it doesn't seem so bad.
No, totally agree with that. Totally agree. Cool. Right. Okay. Let's move on to the little bit of AOS stuff we got. I was actually going to ask Dan, because obviously we know you're a 40k guy, but do you have any interest in AOS at all?
I have interest, and I like the models. I've actually got a small collection of Stormcast, which I need to paint up.
Okay.
There's just never a chance. I've got the Games Workshop release schedule is absolutely crazy at the moment.
Oh, it is.
Just when I think, maybe I'll paint up my Stormcast, you know, Sisters is coming out next month. So it's just, it's always, there's always something 2 weeks away that you want to buy and you want to collect.
Yeah.
And I've also got a very lively community where I live.
Oh, that's
good. Lots of players. And 40K is, there's massive interest in it at the moment. So
yeah, that's understandable.
If I go into my local shop or a gaming club, you know, people are playing 40K.
Mm.
Yeah. And there's just such a buzz about the game at the moment. It's just I'm finding it very, very hard to play, you know, to focus on Age of Sigmar. But Shadespire, or what's it called, the new one?
Beastgrave. Well, it's Underworlds is the sort of global.
The Underworlds, on the other hand, I probably will get into that. I think I'll pick up some of the box sets and I'll get them painted up, because it's just like, you know, three models or four models. I think that's easy.
Yeah.
It's very good value, actually, Underworlds.
Yeah, it's cheap. Yeah, you know, it's, you're getting the cards, you're getting the models. It's good. I mean, compare it to any kind of card game like Magic. You know, the Pokemon trading card game, anything like that. You know, to build up a deck, and it's very reasonably priced.
Yeah, it is actually, because I mean, I think they snuck up the price of the Warbands now in general, because they used to be over here £17.50, whereas now I think they've crept up to 20, but still,
you know,
you're getting, yeah,
they've gone down by $5 over here.
What?
Yeah.
Let me have a look at this. What is going on?
Yeah, I swear I saw that the other day, that because like I said, they've been categorically £17.50 for ages, but yeah, look, they're 20 now. Yeah, the Grim Watch. Oh, actually, sorry, no, tell a lie, the new ones are 20. But look, the older ones are £17.50. They're sort of, because it's now in seasons.
Games Workshop's pricing continues to be super weird.
They've snuck that in, yeah. So, but even at 20, it's still a very, like I said, the fact you're getting between 3 to 9 models, you know, depending, or 7, depending on which warband you pick up, plus you're getting all the cards for £17 to £20, it's actually a very good deal. And remember, you know, like everything to do with these sort of side games is technically enough for you to play, obviously, if you want to delve deeper. But the good thing is, this is like a living card game in the sense that it's not random packs. You know, if you want cards, you buy the pack that you want the cards from, and it's sort of win-win, because obviously what often happens with this game is, obviously, you want, you know, X amount of cards, and say, like, for example, I believe, you know, my sort of newbie understanding with this game now is that, like, Zarg Baggits, which is the Gloomspite type warband, some of the cards in that are very good. But so, you know, as a player, you think, oh, I really want the cards in that. But the fact you get, you know, the eight, or I think it's eight, but like about eight models that come with it, that's a bonus. You know, it's the, because you could easily spend, you know, if you collect these sort of living card games, you could easily spend £15 to £20 just on the cards, and the fact you're getting then the models on top, I think it's actually very good value. And it's definitely a game worth getting into. The only thing you need to consider, especially from a, you know, if anyone gets into this game competitively, like I said, it is now down to seasons. So similar to your Magics and those sort of card games, it does rotate. So basically, in short, the stuff from Beastgrave and the stuff from Night Vault is in rotation at the moment. The Shadespire stuff, well, tell like the universal cards from Shadespire and all the universal cards from season one. So the warbands that came out at that time, they're now out of rotation. So you can use them, obviously, you're playing with your mates and stuff, but if you're in a competitive environment, then they wouldn't be allowed. But that's fine. But, you know, that's comes with the territory.
And they still come with faction-specific cards, which are never rotated out as far as I've been able to tell from what they say. And also with this current season, I've been delving deeper into this. People analyze the card distributions, and it seems like from Beastgrave onwards, warbands are basically going to come with a higher ratio of faction cards to universal cards.
Yeah.
So you're not stuck into one build if you only want to use faction cards, which is great. And also means there's more cards that will survive the tournament scene for longer.
Yeah, that's right. And also, again, slight leak situation is that they've sort of now, through the cards, they've leaked out now really what the next the next warband's going to be. Because obviously, fundamentally, you have six warbands. I thought you would be. There's six warbands, obviously, to a season. Because obviously now we're in the third season with Beastgrave. So obviously, we've now got the two that come with the box. And then obviously, there'll be six that come separately. So obviously, we've had the Grimwatch. Obviously, that's gone up for pre-order, I believe. Or is it actually available now?
It's available today.
Yeah, I saw one
in the wild.
Oh, hope that went well for you. And they've hinted. So now I think, from what I remember, there's going to be a Daughters of Cain one. There's going to be another Orc one, but like an Orc Brute one. There's going to be a Nurgle one. I can't remember the other night.
The other is an Ogol one, which everyone reckons will be an Ice Pelt Tracker and two Saber Tusks, which would be cool. And there is also going to be Ripper's Snarlfangs, which are the Grothorn.
Of course, yes. We've already had those scenes. So,
That'll fill the roster. So it'll probably be the Snarlfangs next. And after that, who knows what might come to be. I'm really excited for this season, as I think I said last time.
And I like the way that, because I've read the Beastgrave rulebook, I like the fact they're tightening things up now. You know, because again, because if you're sort of getting into the game now, you'll see where they've clarified things a bit more. Because I think there's some cards that you'll see and you're thinking, well, that's a bit bombastic or a bit over the top of the wording, but they've had to, because I think that's, you know, like that, like you'll see this in, you know, 40k AOS and other ones. People will try to, you know, read between the lines and sort of manipulate rules to their situation. I think that was happening quite a lot in Underworlds in general, you know, and they thought, no, we have to be very specific about this rule, because otherwise people are misusing it, basically. So, no, exciting times for that. Right, anyway, AOS. So what's going on? So obviously we know the Bone Reapers are on the horizon. Obviously they've hinted at that they're going to be, well, they've said October, but I think the reality is, obviously now it's already the 12th, so the reality is they'll probably go up for pre-order late October.
Yeah, and then maybe to buy November. Yeah, I must say, my local GW store is decked, like, floor to ceiling in cobwebs and skeletons. So I don't know if that's an October in general thing or Bone Reapers pre-celebration, but, you know.
So we know they're on the horizon now, and obviously they've just shown off a bit more for us. So now we've got, which is probably quite a common thing now, obviously, in AOS, where you have a named character slash normal character combination. They sort of, they've done that. You've seen that before, like where they did that with the Deepkin, didn't they? They did that with the Archaelian general, the and one. Oh, what's his name?
It's Virchulot.
He's with a V. Where you can obviously, the same kit can either build the name character or the normal character. So yeah, so they've basically done that. So right. Now we've got, so the named character is Arch Cavalos Xantos, and the normal version is the Liege Cavalos. And so what are you thinking on this?
I mean they're pretty much someone said this on Reddit, I believe, but we love how petty Nagash is, because he looks at all the things Sigma's building out of stuff he's stolen from Nagash, and Nagash goes, I'll build that, but better. And so here is his answer to Lord Celestine's on Drakoths and Dracolines and stuff like that. That they're literally just the Stormcast heroes on mounts, and I love them. They're perfect. Yep. Especially the named character looks fantastic.
He does.
The model's incredible. Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. I think this new release of Age of Sigmar is one of the best looking model lines I've ever seen in either of the model lines. It's just it's amazing.
Yeah, it's very exciting at the time for AOS. That's why I'm quietly confident that over time AOS will generally get bigger. I mean, I'm not saying it will ever overtake 40k in popularity, but I think it's 100% now finding its feet when it comes to the rules, to the model lines. You know, yeah, there's been a lot of, you know, tears over AOS, over tears as in crying tears over AOS in the past, understandably, and obviously in recent times with the Cities of Sigmar, you know, book has obviously made a cull of some of the older models. But, you know, when you're seeing the stuff, the new stuff that's coming out, I mean, it's fantastic. And on a personal level, I think the Bone Reapers have really, I've really swung backwards and forwards with them. When the first reveal came out, I was like, wow, these guys look great. And then there was the last reveal they did, was it the Harvester?
Yeah.
Cameron, is that the right? Harvester. I was a bit, yeah. I was not sold on him. Whereas now, after seeing the Cavalos model now, I'm like, yep, these look great again. I'm swung back around saying how great these are. But no, it's great. And I think I'm personally happy how they've shown these things off now. I think the Bone Reapers, I think we're getting them at a nice pace. You know, we know they're on the horizon, but there's still obviously more to come potentially. And obviously we still, you know, obviously we haven't got the battle tome out yet. And obviously all the rules that come with it. I mean, oh, I dread to think what they're going to be capable of. So yeah, very cool indeed. So yeah. So do you think they're going to do this as a, like they've done before, where they would stagger the release, do you think, from a model perspective?
I would assume so, just because it seems like there's an absolute ton of kits. Like, I reckon the first week will be the Mortark and the basic infantry, and the second week will be the Cavalos, the monsters, the siege engines, and the heavy infantry guys with the four heads.
Yeah.
Okay. It'll be like a 2 week release, I reckon.
Yeah.
Or it might be a three. They could do a deepkin and go for a month and a half, I guess, but I don't think.
Yeah, I was gonna say deepkin. They really stretch.
I think it'll be a 2 or 3 week release as well. I think there's quite a lot of kits.
Yeah.
And if they release too many simultaneously, people just buy less models. So
Yeah. And also, I suppose reality is as well, is that, like you were saying earlier, Dan, with their release schedule in general, regardless of the games, it's, you know, they're pumping stuff out at a crazy rate. At the end of the day, if they, you know, knowing, like I said, you know, realistically, this will creep into early November. And then, like I said, you got Sisters on the horizon, plus anything else, you know, the Christmas battle boxes and battle forces will be out, you know, so they've got to be a bit careful, because like I said, if they stagger it too much, people will literally run out of money and won't buy as much, you know, that's just the way it will be. So, you know, they'll have to be a bit careful with that, but no, it's very exciting. And I can guarantee you, we will be covering the battle tome on this show, but hopefully before the end of the year, depending on when it comes out,
because we'll see how it lines up. Yeah,
exactly. Cool. Right. Okay. Oh, and the other thing I didn't put it on the notes in the end because I forgot about it till this morning. Is the, from the AOS perspective, there's also the new character that they dropped on us. I think it was yesterday, wasn't it? So the Night Questor, Dacian or Dacian Anvil.
Yeah,
another Stormcast.
He's shown up in a burst of lightning in Australia. He's appeared at PAX Australia. I just loved I loved the community article about this. Like, you know, Stormcast are known for three things: they love hammers, they praise Sigmar, and they show up unexpectedly out of nowhere. And like, it's very clear someone has accidentally taken this along to this con and, you know, given it out to the public or something like that.
I did see online that people were saying that it was actually Vulcan has been reforged as a Stormcast.
I mean, it's not the worst idea.
No, I can see it. You got the hammer as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, they've done a little trailer for him, and like I said, a little funny write up. But they've not, I think they've not given the details of how you can buy him, when you can buy him. Obviously, that's coming in the future.
Be available at some point.
Yes,
I feel he might be like the various lieutenants for like con attendance. Like this might be for Adepticon or Nova or something next year. Maybe.
Yeah, possibly
that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
we'll see. We'll see.
Cool. Right. Okay. Well, we'll wrap up and get into the other stuff. So, right, let's start with the big one: Marvel Comics.
Mm.
This is came out of nowhere, so to speak. So, Dan, are you a comic guy? Is this of any interest to you?
I am a comic guy, but I'm not sure that Marvel Comics are the best fit for Warhammer 40k.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
I just don't think they would ever do maybe I'm wrong. I could be completely wrong about this. I think DC could deliver a darker story.
Mm-hmm.
DC Comics in particular.
Mm.
And because Marvel was so closely tied to Disney, if this relationship led to something bigger than just comics, how much would they wash away from what 40k really is? Do you envision like a Disney funded show where like children are kidnapped and like mutilated to be made into super soldiers, and an entire planet's population is killed because they couldn't find one traitor hiding somewhere in a city, or it's like, and these are the good guys, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
Mm. I'm just getting thoughts like sleeping Inquisitor and things like that.
Yeah, and the second like Fulgrim shows up and Slaanesh show up, and it's like, is that Fulgrim's really Disney something princess. Disney would?
It's allowed.
Yes. So Celestine is a Disney princess now, and like,
So
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. It's like Marvel Comics, fine, but it's the affiliation with Disney, which I think, if it led to anything greater than the comic book, I would rather they didn't mess with it. To be honest.
Yeah.
So yeah, fair counterpoint. There is a series called Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe. I want that exact rerun reprinted, but every panel of Deadpool, he's been photoshopped out and Khan the Betrayer has been drawn in. And if Khan the Betrayer kills the Marvel Universe, you can't tell me it wouldn't sell, because it would absolutely sell.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, it's a funny situation, isn't it? Because like I said, I suppose at this stage, we don't really know much of what they're planning with this. Obviously, they've just announced that they're going to be working in cahoots with each other. I'd agree with Dan. I think DC would be probably more appropriate. I was thinking maybe, what was it, 2000 AD? You know, the Judge Dredd side of things, maybe. Even that, because I remember when I was a kid, I mean, I'm not really into comics, but when I used to occasionally buy one, and I bought some of the 2000 AD stuff, some of that stuff was really grim at times, so yeah, maybe that. But then I suppose it depends what they're going for with this, because I suppose as we said earlier, where, you know, it is sort of thought of sometimes that GW is getting a bit more sort of kid friendly, and you know, we have seen that because obviously some of the novels that we've seen recently, and that's not always a bad thing. This could go one of two ways. I'm sort of in between. I'm sort of agreeing with Dan, but I also agree with Cameron in the sense that I think it really depends which way this could go. You know, if they can make it great, or it could sort of stain, you know, 40k and Warhammer in general, depends on how they do this. If it's just a fun little project and that's as far as it goes, then cool. You know, if you like your comics, you like your Warhammer, then there's nothing lost. But like I said, if it then delves into deeper stuff, and you know, I mean, I suppose, to be fair, Disney and Warhammer would get my wife into it at last, maybe. I was thinking. Yeah, yeah. She loves her Disney, so maybe this is the way we do it. But no, it's difficult to say at this point, really. And I suppose it, I mean, if you look at the artist's impression on the actual site when they revealed it, with a very happy-go-lucky ultramarine on there. I mean, he's loving life. He's, you know, he's read the Codex. He's up to speed on things, and he's having his chill time with his comic, you know. So, yeah, I think it depends on how grim it is or not. Yeah, it's we'll see.
Well, Marvel see. Comics could... One thing that I'm not going to question is the quality of the comic in terms of the art style.
Yeah.
So it could look really good.
That's one thing.
That's one thing that Marvel will have going for it, definitely over some like indie line.
Yeah.
But we don't know who's writing the stories. I mean,
no.
This could end up being it could be a Dan Abnett written comic, penned by, you know, drawn by Marvel Comics, which will be amazing, you know. But we just don't know.
I mean, I suppose this is one of the situations where we can, you know, as Warhammer fans, we can have a bit of a, you know, potentially cake and eat it situation, in the sense that, you know, there's been at times in the past where we moaned about, say their video game IPs, for example, where how many times as Warhammer fans we've gone, oh, why don't they do this sort of game? And, you know, then they'll do some really big things, like, you know, the Dawn of War, Space Marine was a really good game. But then unfortunately we've had some very, you know, very underwhelming video games where they've been given the license and no disrespect to it, but they just not the studio's just not been big enough or had the budget enough to deliver what we as Warhammer fans expect. So what the point I'm trying to get to is now GW is mixing with the big boys. You know, they've just done the Primaris intercessors with Bandai. They're now teaming up with Marvel, one of the biggest companies, or, you know, from a hobby perspective in the world. So, you know, should we be, you know, the flip side is, should we be moaning at this? Because thinking, actually, no, they're doing what they should be doing. They're actually moving and making deals with the guys that will deliver, as opposed to the people that may not. You know, it depends. Depends which way, what your take on it is. But we'll see. We'll see indeed. Right, okay. Next, the Black Library Weekender. That, I believe, is the 9th and the 10th of November, if my memory is working.
I believe you are correct.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure you're right on that.
Yay, I remembered something. So they've shown that off. Obviously, that is going to be an opportunity for people to obviously meet the Black Library authors, which I would have loved to have gone to, but I can't remember. I think I just didn't get the chance to go to it. Because I would like to meet some of them. But they've shown off some of the upcoming books. What's quite exciting, we're looking at another Blood Angels book that looks like it's carrying on from Devastation of Baal.
This is the sequel to Devastation of Baal.
Yes.
I actually messaged Guy Haley about it, and he has verified this is the continuation of the story.
Yes.
And I am so excited about this book because Dante, Devastation of Baal, unbelievable stories. So.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is very cool. I mean, I think Devastation of Baal is one of our favorite books that we've spoke about on here, I'd say, Cameron. Well, I think it was anyway.
Oh, yeah. It is like top three. I'm not sure what the other two are, but Baal is up
there. It's probably in the new setting, in the post-Gathering Storm setting, it's probably either the best or the second best book next to the great work Belisarius Cole.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely incredible story. So
yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. Whenever I'm on like Reddit or other forums and people say, you know, what's a good 40K book to get into? And obviously everyone says Eisenhorn. That's always the default answer for a lot of people. But because often the person asking it is, you know, quite new to it, hence why they're asking the question. So I always say Devastation of Baal. I'm like, just do it, get it. It's such a good book. And, you know, so much so that I own, I think I own at least three copies. I think I've got the audio, I've got the paperback. I swear I've got another copy elsewhere. It's such a good book. So the fact that they've snuck out this sequel, because I didn't even know a sequel was in play for this. But I'm not complaining. Yeah. I can't wait for this. So
absolutely.
How does Guy Haley do it?
I mean, he's a machine.
He is a machine. Yeah. He's churning out these novels, these like 700-page books. Clearly not. So I feel like every 3 months is a new Guy Haley book.
Yeah. Because he's also doing a bunch of stuff for Siege of Terror, isn't he?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
He's
part AdMech. He's just
he's working already on written all of these, and he's just releasing them slowly.
Maybe he is working on Dark Imperium Part 3 as well, which I can't wait to get my hands on. So yeah, I just don't know how he does it. You see the other authors kind of like release one book maybe every 2 years, and he's just churning out four a year. Like it's crazy, but the quality is so high.
Yeah.
Mm. And his books as well, they're very consistent with each other.
Yes.
And there's like little bits of plots and little bits of like characters continue from one book to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like the Guy Haley Warhammer universe. And I think just if you could just basically pick up his books like Dante, Devastation of Baal, Dark Imperium 1, 2, Called the Grey Work, and it just feels like one grand story in different parts of the galaxy. It's fantastic.
Mm. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, it can be dangerous when one person, you know, is in charge of this, but luckily, because Guy Haley is so damn good, it works, because he's, like you said, considering how quick he is at getting novels out, the standard is there as well, because obviously that could easily slip as part of this. But I think he's probably realistically, he's obviously just naturally a very fast writer. He's just obviously got a skill for doing that. But I think also, secondly, because, you know, they've probably unofficially, you know, charged him with pushing the narrative forward, because the fact that, you know, he's the in charge of been doing, you know, obviously, like you said, Dark Imperium and obviously Devastation of Baal and Great Work and things like that. So the continuity is there and the consistency is there, because obviously it's not like he's having to sort of continue off what someone else is doing. He's in charge of it as such, and he's probably just enjoying it. It's probably just such a, you know, privilege for him to go, right, yes, I'm actually writing the Indomitus era, I think it's now known as, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, he's probably just really just taking full advantage of it. And it's great, because it benefits us as fans and readers, because we get, you know, we get some great stuff coming our way. So
we also get this really good consistency with the stories as well as a result. The characters are behaving as they should. They feel like it's the same character from book to book, because when you have so many authors working on novels, sometimes a character might not feel the same from one book to the next. I felt this was particularly strong in the Horus Heresy. In the first three books, Horus was so politically minded and charismatic in the very first book. And he felt like a completely different character by the time he fell. And obviously his allegiance has changed, but he didn't seem anywhere near as, how can I put this, as clever in a way. Does that make sense?
Like an evolution, you mean?
Yeah. It just maybe not consistent as a character the way he was written. I'm not saying the stories are bad. It just didn't feel quite the same. Whereas the Guy Haley kind of books, because they are so quickly put out, it must be fresh in his mind as well.
Yeah.
And he's keeping track of all these different characters, these different locations, settings. It is just very...
I wouldn't argue with that. I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, he's, I suppose, hopefully not experiencing any burnout off the back of this, because obviously that's... Because I know that some of the other Black Library authors suffer with that. And obviously that can have consequences as well. But he's bringing some great stuff to the table. And the thing is, he's that sort of author where every time he does a book, I just think, this is going to be good. You know, it's almost like I always feel confident even before I've written it. Read it. I'm secretly writing for him. That's how he gets it all done. That's why I've never got any time. Before I've even read a book of his, I was like, yep, this is going to be good. It's because it's Guy Haley. He's just consistent. But it's shown, actually, this Black Library weekend, it's obviously shown off some of the upcoming ones as well. What I'm really looking forward to on the AOS side is that Court of the Blind King, which is that Deepkin, the full first Deepkin novel that we've ever seen by David Geimer. Can't wait for that.
It's going to be so good. Yeah.
Mm. So that's, I think that goes up November, I think. November pre-order, I believe. And obviously they've shown off the Novella Series 2, which were, I think the first one was always really cool. Obviously we've got the range of the horror books that are coming. I've pre-ordered about four of them. yeah, I think, like I said, there's some really exciting stuff to come. And I think what I'm quite enjoying as well, talking about Black Library, is the fact that since they've updated their sort of coming soon way of showing things, obviously it used to be on the actual Black Library page, whereas obviously now it's now on the community page. I like, it's good for us as podcasters because we can sort of almost pre-plan stuff. That book's coming out in February, so we can we know exactly when to tackle it. So it's very cool. Is any other books you two are very excited about seeing soon?
Josh Reynolds writing horror is something I'm really looking forward to. So we'll see how that goes. In general, the Novella series I'm really looking forward to, just because series one was pretty much universally good. Like, there were a few that weren't amazing, but they were all at the very least quite enjoyable. So I want to see what happens in season two of Novella Land.
Novella Land. Cool. Dan, is there any others that you've seen that you're particularly looking forward to?
Yeah, this isn't a new release, but I want to download the Apocalypse book. Apparently, it's quite a good story. It's just called, it's one of the Space Marine Crusade series.
Yes.
It's just called Apocalypse. Apparently, it's quite good.
Yeah.
But I also want to get my hands on the Sabbat World Crusade book. Which is coming out, I think, just before or during the weekend. So I think that would be very cool to flick through.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, Apocalypse is good. I've read it. It's very good, actually. I mean, it's Josh Reynolds, and like Cameron was saying, he's always a great consistent writer as well. It's just an overall good novel. You know, lore wise, does it bring much? Arguably not. But I don't think that's the purpose of it. And the key thing to understand, if you're not familiar with the background to it, is that Josh wrote it in a very quick, I think he did it in a month. He wrote it exceptionally quick. And from my understanding, from what I've read, and he has sort of said it on his, like his website and such like, is that basically he had a lot of ideas for it. And that, you know, he basically got a lot of them were shut down. And so I think basically the novel he ended up writing was not what he wanted it to be, but the flip side is it's still very good because luckily he's a very good writer, so it shone through. And I actually messaged him as well to say that, because I think you could tell, you know, reading between the lines, that he was quite annoyed by being shut down, you know, from a lot of his ideas, because obviously, you know, effectively he's a freelance author. And I messaged him saying, look, you know, from what I've read, you know, you're obviously pissed off about that, but don't worry, Apocalypse was really good. So yeah, Dan, I definitely recommend you pick it up. It's definitely a worthwhile one. And
ask him about what his ideas were?
No, I've spoken to Josh before because because I've been trying to get him on the show because he has agreed to come on the show at some point, but unfortunately he's very busy at the moment. Again, he seems to be very burnt out, I think, from Warhammer in general at the moment. From what I gather, again, I'm reading between the lines from, not necessarily I've spoken to him personally about that. I just mean when you read some of his, you know, comments online. And so, no, I didn't get a chance to ask him that. But I think, you know, despite that, it's definitely worth picking up. And, I mean, luckily, and hence why I've pre-ordered so much, Amazon seemed to be doing a lot of the paperbacks for about £6 at the moment. They all seem to be a lot, you know, cheaper than most places, and I think Apocalypse is in that as well, so definitely worth picking up. And it's quite a big novel as well, from memory. It's quite, you know, quite a meaty one, but very good as well, so definitely recommend that one. Right, okie doke, so let's move on to Warcry. So I forgot this actually was revealed recently for a while back. It feels like it, even though it was only like within the last couple of weeks, they sort of just ran, wasn't it? They sort of randomly just threw some news out about this. And I think we're all a bit like, oh, okay, that's lovely. So they've obviously the starter set is now out of print as of such, which I don't know. How do you feel about that?
I mean, they said it's out of print in its current form, so I have no doubt that it will show up again, maybe with different warbands or a different terrain set. I have no doubt that there will be like another run of a starter set, just like there's been another run of a kill team starter set. So
yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's no surprise. I mean, it's a bit quicker than I thought it was going to be, as in it going out of print. Because obviously, like you said, they did that with Kill Team, but it was a little while before they did that. Or maybe time's going so quick and Warcry's been out for that long. It just seems like 5 minutes. But, you know, it's not the end of the world, because obviously as part of this, they're releasing the terrain separately, like the Azerite Rune Chapel, for example, which I think is a good chunk of the terrain, but it's not all of it, from what I understand. Yeah. And there'll be a separate box for that. Obviously, they've also revealed the Tome of Champions, which will obviously give you all the other warbands that are not in not in the other material, so we're all in one place. So it's basically like, I suppose, a bit like a chapter-approved General's Handbook, isn't it? But for Warcry, that's how it looks to me, anyway, from what I can understand. And then, obviously, what else they're doing is they have shown off the very first of the Spire Tyrants as well, haven't they, Cameron?
Yeah, they've shown off precisely one Spire Tyrant. He looks like a big, beefy marauder boy in some bondage gear, and I'm not opposed. he looks classic Chaos, which I actually quite like. So,
yeah. Well, from a lore perspective, that's what they're supposed to be from memory. Spire Tyrants are the ones that sort of try to excel above everyone else. You know, they're quite, like you say, quite standard Chaos, aren't they, from memory? So that's quite fitting. And then obviously they've showed off another big boy, which is the Fomoroid Crusher. So, yeah, again, quite unexpected as well to see him. So, Dan, have you got any interest in Warcry at all?
I do. I'm surprised the box set, the core rulebook set, just disappeared. It does feel very, very quick.
Yeah.
I wonder how successful this game has been. I've not actually seen anyone show particular interest in my local group. That's not to say it's not been a big success outside of it. But we have Necromunda, we have Underworlds, we have Kill Team, and now we have Warcry. I don't know if this is something I'll ultimately invest in, but the core set that's gone out of print was amazing. The terrain and the models were incredible. So yeah. I'm quite sad to see that go so quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would say Warcry is pretty popular. When I popped into my store this morning, they were running a tournament, actually. So it's a whole bunch of people playing Warcry there. But I feel Warcry is difficult to measure the success for on Games Workshop side, because you have the Warcry-specific stuff. Like, you have the core set, you've got the rulebook, you've got the six Chaos warbands. But then a whole bunch of people are getting into Warcry by playing the non-Chaos factions. And there's not a solid indicator that, you know, a particular purchase is for Warcry. So, like, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's been decently successful, at least. And I know it's going to continue to be supported. We're getting the Tome of Champions, we're getting more warbands, we're getting new monsters, which that Fomorian Crusher is so cool. I love it. It's just, I feel it might be a shelf space thing. Is another one of these, like, you know, we have limited capacity for production and storage. We're still building that whole other factory they announced last year, I think it was, that they were starting on. So it is a big box. It takes up a lot of space. And you know, it'll be back one way or another, and it'll stay popular just because it's a simple cinematic rule set. What I hope, at least.
Yeah. And also, they've highlighted that despite the set going away, realistically, you just need the book, you need a warband, and you need some terrain, so which is all accessible. So, yeah, I think Warcry has always felt like an experiment to me. I mean, even when we were at Warhammer Fest, and they were sort of saying that, obviously, you know, it originally came from the fact it was the studio had made some Chaos, you know, some Chaos warbands, and they're like, oh, let's make a game off the back of it. And you know, I think it feels like it's been successful, but again, that's always a very hard thing to judge. I think that why I think it's where I'm sort of coming around to it being an experiment is they probably just built or created so many of the starter set, for example, and thought, you know, this is the number we're happy with building. If obviously, and then obviously if it turns out the Warcry isn't as popular, then it's not the end of the world. And but obviously if it is, we'll do another set. And we've proven that people want this. And, you know, similar to probably what they did with Kill Team. And I think it's in that place, but I think it's in a safe place because, like I said, the fact they're doing this tome, obviously they've still got more Warbands to come out. You know, a few of us played it at Warhammer World a few months ago, and that I personally enjoyed it. It's a really quick and easy game to play. You know, we were playing, you know, a four player, and it still came out really quickly, and it's quite easy to pick up. And obviously, that's the sort of the deliberate side behind it. So I still think it's got a lot of legs behind it. I don't think it's going anywhere away. It's just obviously they're sort of now. It's now, you know, a bit on. They're probably thinking, right, let's get rid of this starter set. We've sold all those. We'll get another one out in time, and they'll just concentrate on, you know, releasing these separate smaller packages, you know, warbands and expansions, etc. So, no, let's watch this space as always.
Yeah, I mean, they have supported it, and the model releases are very cool. I like the Corvus Cabal. That's does some very interesting looking models, and yeah. Yeah, I mean, I might, if I see anyone playing it and they're up for a game, I'd love to give it a try.
Yeah, well, it's I would say it's probably one of the easier games for you. You know, if you've got someone there that's got a couple of warbands and has obviously played it once or twice, it's a very easy one to pick up. You know, it's not one of those where, you know, even the bigger games, you know, if you've never played them before, they can be a bit of a slog to initially get your head around. Whereas I think Warcry was definitely one. You know, considering, like I said, when we played it at Warhammer World in Bugman's, and there was none of us had never played it before, it was quite straightforward to pick up. You know, we did get it pick up really easily. So I think it's one of those where, you know, you could have a quick game for half an hour, and then ultimately you could decide there and then whether you wanted to carry on into it or not. You know, because it's that sort of game where yes, there is expansions. Yeah, there is obviously differentiating bands and things like that. But at the end of the day, if you like a game of it, you'll probably like carry on playing it. If you didn't like the game, you probably wouldn't. You know, it's that sort of quite black and white situation, really. But no, definitely give it a try if you see it. It's worth it. And the last bit of news in the last couple of weeks, I think they're now up for purchase today, I believe, unless I'm wrong, is the Horus Heresy Dark Angel stuff that's now out upon Forge World. This stuff is gorgeous, if I'm being honest. The Dark Angels in Heresy stuff always looks cool. So obviously we've seen a couple of these shown off a while ago. Like I know that, for example, the Terminator Praetor were shown off, but they didn't show us the normal armor, you know, power armored Praetor before. And he arguably looks even better.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's a lot of conversion and kit bashing ideas that are probably going through people's minds after seeing these models. They look really good. What do you guys think?
Dark Angels. I think these are the best, probably the best Heresy looking kind of unique models next to the Blood Angel guys. They're really good as well. And I think these later releases have really improved over the first batch of kind of characters they did, like Abaddon and Loken. And I just think these Dark Angel characters are just absolutely fantastic. I will pick this model up to use in a 40k game if I wasn't playing Horus Heresy. It's that good.
Yeah. I'd echo that. What about you, Cameron? Yeah.
Pretty much 100% agree. They are absolutely bloody awesome.
It's when you see stuff like this and you go, no, I don't have the time or money for Heresy as well.
Yeah.
And also,
look at the Leviathan as well, because the Leviathan's coming out, and that's obviously a very, very popular unit in the game of 40k. I don't see any reason why a Dark Angel player wouldn't be using this new Dark Angel Leviathan. It just looks absolutely fantastic, I think.
Yeah, some nice little touches. I love like the lion's head shield on the left kneecap and things like that. It's just lovely. Again, it's full of lovely little bits of detail. The only thing that slightly spoilt the Praetor for me is, and I'm talking about the one without the helmet, he looks like Graham Norton to me. And if you're familiar who that is.
Yes, a little bit of Grimwarden is in him, yeah.
And I'm like, no, I cannot unsee this anymore. So I'd stick that helmet on him. Luckily, it's a very cool helmet.
No, the helmet's awesome. It's like an old crusading knight helmet. It's very cool.
Well, I think that's why I like their stuff more than their 40k stuff for the Dark Angels, because it is that old knight heraldry, you know, thing that obviously is a big part of their lore. Whereas I think, you know, they've slightly gone away from that, obviously naturally, because obviously they're part of the evolution. But yeah, like I said, I think this model could easily, and to be fair, it could fit in a lot of non-Dark Angels marine stuff. I mean, I'm sure if you're a Black Templar player, this would definitely be potentially something you'd want to buy as well. I think they're lovely, to be honest. There's some really cool stuff.
It just when I look at these guys, because they're so full of character, with all these like little flares of Dark Angel iconography, the wings on the helmets, all this kind of stuff. They make the Primaris look a bit bland by comparison. I mean, I know it's a much newer range. Mm. Okay, bland is the wrong word. Maybe more homogenized. And one thing that I'm quite disappointed in Games Workshop and Forge World for not doing is, where's all the Primaris upgrade sprues?
Yeah.
Why hasn't Forge World just released like a bunch of different looking helmets, backpacks, like bolter types just for Primaris? We have such a great like support for all the classic Marine kits. And I think it's a missed opportunity. And the Games Workshop plastic upgrade sprues are so bland. You know, it's just a few shoulder pads and a helmet. Mm. Whereas we could have, there could be a lot more to them, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it does feel that it's a bit of a missed opportunity. And I think, and it's a shame, really, because knowing that Primaris Marines are a bit of a contentious subject for people, you know, a lot of people don't like them, and because again it's taken away from the, you know, the intricacies of the older Marines, it's a shame that, like I said, at least they could almost use that as a selling point. So yeah, you may find the Primaris quite bland in comparison, but look at all this cool stuff and gubbins you can get for them that makes them really different. And that would definitely, I think it would turn some people's heads, but
I don't think they could ever do that. Yeah, I don't think they could ever go quite as far as it did with the Heresy Marines, because these are, I mean, I'm looking at this Dark Angel Praetor and he's incredibly stylized. The armor's almost unrecognizable. You know, what kind of armor is it? Yeah. It's like completely unique. Whereas the Primaris are very much, there is a slight design shift. They are more kind of modern sci-fi, if that makes sense. They're not like 80s hard rock sci-fi. It's like, it's more Mass Effect style sci-fi. Yeah. But it's still very grim, dark 40k. So they couldn't quite go as far as these models, but I'm just really surprised Forge World hasn't supported them more. Like, where's my weapon options for the Redemptor Dreadnought? Just like some new arms and stuff. Like, it just feels like Forge World's complete. They released that giant Astraeus battle tank, which is really cool, and then they haven't followed up with a single Primaris focus release.
I think it's just highlighting what a funny place Forge World is in at the moment. I completely agree with you, because I find it baffling, but I think it's just highlighting that Forge World is in a funny place. And because I say it from the AOS side, I'm like, why is there so little AOS stuff over there? And I think that because of I just have a feeling that in the near future, something big is going to happen with Forge World in general. I think we'll see a situation where they will almost get taken. When I say get taken over from GW, I know obviously GW owns them, but I mean like from an actual production and, you know, point of view. Because the problem is these things are lagging behind. Because like, for example, I watched Kyrios' YouTube video the other day where he was talking about, I don't know if you saw it, Cameron, where he was basically, he was shocked that the other Primarchs still even aren't out yet. Like, you know, that Heresy's been out.
Where's the line?
And yeah, it's like, Why are these models not out? And the problem is, obviously, fundamentally, I know, obviously, we've had, there's been issues like, obviously, when, was it Alan Blythe? I think that's his name, wasn't it? That when he passed away, unfortunately, which obviously was a massive hit for them. But they just don't have the people over there. Well, that's what they always gets portrayed when you talk about Forge World. They just don't have the, like, literally the manpower over there to get to, you know, whereas obviously in comparison, obviously GW is churning stuff out at a crazy rate. So it's almost like there needs to be some, they need to bridge a gap there somewhere.
I think, I mean, they are focusing more on these specialist games like Titanicus and Necromunda. So that's obviously going to take a lot of their time. But Forge World, if you go back a couple of years, they very much were like supporting the plastic releases of 40K with upgrade bits, with cool new models, with the occasional unit. And, you know, that's gone now because of, because of the specialist games, perhaps. And whilst we can all understand it, it doesn't mean we have to like it.
Fair point. I think it just, people, I think they just need to give it Forge World a bit of direction. You know, they need to go, right, if, you know, it wouldn't be a bad thing if they said, right, what we're going to do is we're not going to focus on any of this anymore. And we're going to focus, you know, if they've got six things to focus on, we're only going to focus on these two or three things. You know, if they said, right, we're going to definitely finish up the heresy stuff. We're definitely going to get the Primarchs out. And we're going to focus on, like I said, the specialist games like, you know, like Necromunda. Unfortunately, AOS, you're not going to see anything. Okay, that's fine. I mean, obviously, that would not, people wouldn't like that, but if they go, you know what, whatever we sell currently for AOS, that's all you can buy now. When, you know, we have no plans to release anything else for it because we're devoting all our attention. Then, again, it's that transparency and people know where they stand for better or worse at the end of the day. And I think that's what I feel like they need to do with Forge World, because people are sort of, well, I feel they do anyway. People just trying to work out what their objective is at times, really, because it is a bit up in the air. But I suppose, again, as always, we'll see what happens. I think something in the next year feels like it'll be on the horizon, I think, anyway. I'm calling it now. Cool. Okay. Well, I think that's been it for the news. So we've had plenty to talk about. So we'll take our next break. And then guess what? After the break, we're going to talk about more Primaris stuff. Back soon.
Yay.
Fantastic.
Okay. We're back. And we're back to talk about the Space Marines Codex. How very exciting. So this is the second version. From memories, and it's second version for 8th edition at least of this book. And let's be honest, I suppose we could see this one coming, to be honest, with all the lovely new units that have have graced the shelves in the last sort of 6 months to a year. It's no surprise that they thought, let's get another one out. And then it's sort of, I don't know if it's the same for you guys, but I look at my shelf and I'm thinking, God, how many Space Marine Codexes have I got up there? Like, because I've got like the last one, I've got the 7th edition one, and then how many do I need?
Storage issues, at this point.
Exactly. So like I said, we'll talk about the Codex, and as we've done before with other books, we're sort of just going to be sort of a bit fast and loose with it, in the sense that we'll just sort of pick out, you know, between the three of us, anything that we thought was of interest. Because, you know, if I'm being brutally honest, a lot of it is what you would expect it to be. You know, a lot of, you know, we know what Space Marines are and what they get up to in their own time. and obviously a lot of that is highlighted in this book. But like I said, it's where I find, you know, personally, this the new Codex is quite interesting. Is obviously you see it's how things relate to, obviously, the Great Rift and obviously primarily how the Primaris are dealing, you know, or being integrated, I should say, into the existing chapters. And then obviously we'll, you know, talk about any chapters, particularly some of the successor ones, which are of note, because there is quite a few interesting ones in there that you may or may not be aware of. And then, like I said, we'll talk about all the various units. Again, a lot of them, you know, I'll be honest, have not changed that much, because obviously they're still doing what they used to. But obviously we'll focus particularly on a lot of the newer units, obviously particularly the Vanguard, because obviously they are still a bit unknown for a lot of people. So I'll start with you, Dan. So, you know, in again, I'm talking obviously purely from a lore perspective. What did you feel about this codex and the new stuff? Do you feel it's quite good?
Yeah, it's good. It's what I expected. But I still feel that the books don't delve as deeply as the novels do. I think more than ever, you need to invest into, if you are into the lore of 40K, if you want to know about it, more than ever, the codex doesn't give you enough, I think. You have to really delve into the books. However, the codex is still great. I love all the little snippets about fights that have been won, lost. The timelines are always good. It hasn't changed drastically from the previous one. You know, there isn't some incredible information in the codex which wasn't there before. It just goes, it's a little bit more up to date with the timeline. But it's as I expected.
Yeah. No, that's fair points. How about yourself, Cameron?
I've never actually owned a Space Marine Codex before, so it's a first for me.
Congratulations.
Oh. Yeah,
I don't believe that.
Oh, no. Seriously, it's my first. I mean, unless you count Death Guard, they are a type of Space Marine. This is literally my first Space Marine Codex. I was surprised to find how many little details I had been previously unaware of, because you know, Space Marines are kind of the center poster boys of 40K. Everyone feels they know pretty much everything about them, even if you haven't delved too deeply. And I've been punished for my hubris, because reading through this, I've found all these cool little tidbits. I was like, oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's pretty rare. Why did no one make a point to like make this known wherever information on Space Marines is disseminated?
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, like offhand example, I didn't know there were no official successors for the Salamanders. I didn't know there was that whole thing where they weren't broken up as a legion.
They've got really unstable gene seed. It's very very cool lore. It's the same with the Space Wolves until Dark Imperium, where they made that Wolf Spear chapter. There had been no successors of the Space Wolves. There was one in the past which failed. And there's various chapters which have kind of degraded gene seed. And up until the Primaris were introduced, it was becoming harder and harder for them to make new Marines, which is very interesting.
Yeah. Do you feel that sometimes the, you know, going off on the back of what you just said, because I agree with you, Cameron, there's some bits where I'm like, wow, I didn't actually really know that until it's highlighted to you. Do you feel that primarily the big four, do you feel that sometimes, again, talking from a lore perspective, do you feel that they dominate almost a bit too much? And sometimes these, you know, even the net, you know, if I group the big four and then you think of the other, first founding ones like your Salamanders, your Iron Hands, Raven Guard, etc. Do you feel that they sometimes, you know, people don't often know as much about these primarily because they just don't have as much attention?
Yeah, I think, there's only, because they all, they're like the under the umbrella of one faction. The Space Marines are one particular faction. And you've also got the sub-factions of Dark Angel. Sub-factions, that's wrong, really. But they're chapters which are broadly similar. And I think there's only so many model releases you can do for a chapter, basically, before it starts to get stale. For Space Marines, I should say. If you have... They staggered the releases of the old codexes. So you had like the Space Marine book came out, and then like months later you got Dark Angels, then Blood Angels, then Space Wolves. But they were broadly written in the same time. But you can't just have 6 months of Space Marine releases. And I think for the same reason, you can't just focus on multiple different chapters. But I think now more than ever, they're doing it with these supplement books. And just having a unique character and a full book showing you the chapter in your color, some successes, a bit of background lore. I think that's really fleshing out these lesser chapters as well. Less popular chapters.
Choose your words carefully.
Yeah. Well, they're not lesser, are they? The Iron Hands are now the new kings of the games.
No, I know what you mean. No, I think that's a good point, because I mean, even myself, who, you know, has been into the hobby for a long time, I even ones like like the Iron Hands, I feel because they're now in the forefront, because obviously they've now, obviously there's the, obviously the Codex, then obviously there's the supplement, and obviously from, you know, if you're into your meta, the Iron Hands are supposed to be quite tasty out there. You find that, you know, obviously people are talking about them, it then obviously naturally draws your attention to them. And I must admit, they're one of the chapters that I've always not really ever given much attention to. And that, no particular reason, just, you know, they've just been under the, you know, under the floorboard, so to speak, that for quite a while. And, you know, and obviously now they're coming to the forefront. And I never realized, for example, how really grim and morose and self-hating they were until I looked more into them. I didn't realize, I mean, obviously I knew about obviously the cybernetics and replace, you know, they willingly replace limbs with obviously modifications and stuff, such like, but I did sort of realize, but it's until you read it, you don't realize, like, for example, how much hatred they, well, not, or how much, depending on which Marine you're talking about, how much hatred and thing they have for obviously other Marines, but also even to their own Primarch, you know, Ferris Manus. Like, they really, in some cases, are really disheveled by what he did, you know, obviously which led to his death, you know, by, you know, going headlong into, you know, to the fight, and obviously with Fulgrim, and spoiler, gets his head chopped off. And you know, and then obviously they end up having potential hatred for the Raven Guard, the Salamanders, because obviously they didn't feel like they supported them. And then once you start, like you said, Dan, like when you know, you see these overviews, but when you actually start delving deeper into some of these chapters, they're actually far more interesting than you would think. And I think it's easy to almost beat upon Space Marines when it comes to the lore, because they're thrown in your face, because they are the poster boys. It's so easy to think, oh yeah, Space Marines, you know, whatever. And I personally find when you read some of these successor chapters, especially, is you see these little nuances and almost you see some very anti, Marine sort of behavior, you know, where they, and how they vary so much. Like, you know, you've got, you know, certain chapters, like, you know, obviously a lot of them are, you've got quite a few crusading chapters, for example. You've got, you know, some chapters like the subjugators, who will happily take out a whole planet. They don't care. Just that's all. And then you've got I'm trying to remember the name of them. I think it's the Silver Templars who you know, get very grief stricken if they lose their weapon, because they you know, and things like that. And it's like, you know, and you got ones that have facial scarring, and, you know, and it's not just, you know, the wolves, the angels, you know, the stoic ultramarines, and that's it. There's some real deeper depths, and quite grim depths as well. Would you guys agree with that?
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah.
Yep.
I think. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was just saying there's some of that dark mystery stuff, like for successor chapters for the Raven Guard. Like, you've got the Death Spectres, who are literally, they're a Space Marine chapter, like the Carcharodons. They exist outside the bounds of the Imperium space, and their job is to watch a single star system, because we're not told what was ever in that star system, but the point is, it's so bad that whatever's in there, there's an entire chapter of Space Marines dedicated to making sure this one thing does not leave that star system. It's like, don't know what it is, it's a problem.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's very, very cool lore. I think one thing that's been a stumbling block for people in the past, up until this new codex, is that you might delve into these chapters and research their lore and stuff. It's very, very good, but you have no real way of actually playing them on the tabletop. You have to pick a chapter tactic from someone else. Whereas now, finally, you can actually, you know, build a chapter to with the rules that you kind of want them to have, to illustrate their, you know, the way they fight. So I think with this new codex in particular, after delving into the other chapters, and with the creator chapter rule set, I think we'll see a lot more variety amongst themed players. But I think when it comes to the meta, we'll see basically Iron Hands and maybe Raven Guard.
Someone did a Reddit thread where they crunched the numbers on killing an Iron Hands dreadnought.
Hammer of Math. Boss.
Yeah. And there's like, you know, a Warlord Titan has like a 75% chance of killing it in one turn.
Yeah, a 6,000 like, points Warlord Titan.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's three times out of four, it'll get the job done to kill that one dreadnought. I'm like, excuse me? Okay.
People love their number crunching.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's not always the tabletop.
Yeah. Oh, no. But it's interesting. It's interesting.
Yeah. To see. Oh, absolutely. No, I totally agree. I mean, from the sort of before we get into the actual chapters, from the sort of actual general side of things, I mean, I'll direct this at Cameron particularly because obviously, you know, was there anything you sort of felt that, you know, that you think, hang on, I really didn't know that the way they, like, especially when it comes to like the way that they're set up or, you know, the way their reserves, the Vanguard, you know, anything that sort of really stood out to you particularly?
Let's see. I would say I was pretty familiar with general company and chapter setups. Like I knew the path of a tactical marine through stuff. What I didn't realize is that there are like these multiple generations of Primaris Marines. So there is the initial wave of like cloned material style, like literally Star Wars prequels, Clone Wars, Primaris Marines, who the only thing they know is how to be an intercessor or how to be a Hellblast or how to be an aggressor. They don't know how to fulfill any other battlefield role. But now a standard Primaris Marine raised within the chapter goes through a similar path to what a tactical Marine would have gone through. But instead of being in normal power armor and fulfilling, you know, the Devastator and the Assault and the vehicle roles, they get to try out all the variations to the Mark 10 Tacticus armor because, you know, you can up or de-armor it to fulfill different roles and make the different kinds of Primaris armor. This is like, yeah, you know, you start out, you do your scout stuff, apparently, and then you go and you be a Reaver for a bit, then you're an Aggressor for a bit, then you're an Inceptor for a bit, then a Hellblaster, and finally you become an Intercessor. And it's that same path, and I didn't realize Primaris Marines actually went through that same path. It makes sense now that I know it, but
well, yeah. I think you've highlighted it. It wasn't always obvious because, like I sort of said earlier in the show, where it felt like the Gathering Storm bringing into Primaris was almost very quick. You know, I'm talking from a lore perspective. Like, right, here you go. Here's a Primaris Marines. Is that it? You know, and like you said, obviously these initial ones, these cloned ones, have been on ice under Mars, you know, brought there, and they're obviously brought out to sleep and then just literally thrown out into this universe. And obviously, like you said, they're not specialized. They are specialized. They're specialized only in whatever they know they can do. They're not sort of flexible. I like that, actually. I like the fact that the initial ones were, because, you know, fresh off the block, they're sort of straight off the conveyor belt, so to speak. That felt, I don't know, I suppose real. Like, you know, if 40K was real, I know it is. I know 40K is real, but don't dampen people's dreams. But, you know, if this was actually a legitimate situation, that to me is how things would ride out. You wouldn't be able to bring these Marines out of stasis and just, you know, they can just like pick up anything because they don't have the experience. Literally, you know, why would they have the experience? They wouldn't. They've been on ice for 10,000 years until Call has brought them out. And so it makes perfect sense that, you know, that yes, they are stronger, they are bigger and, you know, and flashier, so to speak. But, you know, compared to the existing Marines, you know, they lack, you know, what is obviously a very crucial thing. And then it's nice to see that evolution where they're like, no, you know, we're going to go back to basics because ultimately that has worked for Marines. I know they're obviously always up against it, but ultimately that path of, you know, scout to, you know, to Devastator, Assault, to then Tactical, and then obviously, you know, maybe Terminator down the line. You know, that makes sense because obviously, and then that's sort of, you know, why should the Primaris be any different? I suppose is the way I've always looked at it.
I think they couldn't. You just mentioned like how they go from let's say like Reaver to Infiltrator to whatever. I think they probably couldn't do that initially because there wasn't the model line. They're limited in the lore they show us by the models they've released. They don't write about things which we can't buy, with the exception of the Overlord gunship, in fact, which is bigger than a Stormbird, apparently.
One day we'll get it.
I think as they release more kits, we'll hear about the training more, we'll hear about how they progress more. It's going to fill in all the gaps as well, because for a long time, they didn't even talk about how these Marines get around. You know, now we've got the Impulsor. So now we know they actually have like a fast transport. So before you just kind of assume, do they get teleported into battle? I mean, in Dark Imperium, they mentioned that the repulsors drop from space, if I remember correctly.
There was
that one scene where an Iron Warrior looks up and he just sees these two bricks falling and they kind of slow down before they hit the ground. So, I mean, that's pretty cool, but the Codex doesn't make any mention of that. So... No. You know, so if anyone asks, like, what do they use for drop pods? Repulsors. So,
Yeah, I suppose it is that filling in the gaps situation. No, I totally agree. I think, like you said, from a model perspective, they would have to have slowly, you know, released them like they have done, where obviously, you know, adding more model lines. But again, from a lore perspective, I suppose, again, it makes sense because, you know, you're not going to have all this specialism. Like I said, when it's been on ice for so long, it has to, you know, that's how how any soldiers gain experience is by literally living and breathing in these fights. And obviously, and that's now what we're seeing, because obviously, you know, the Domus Crusade has finished. It was 100 odd years long. And now obviously we're dealing with all these things like, you know, like Vigilus and in recent times, and obviously what we're going to see with Psychic Awakening. It makes perfect sense now that, right, okay, you know, these Primaris are not just straight out of the freezer. They're now integrated fully into chapters. There's Primaris chapters. And obviously now they're gaining experience. They're now specializing even more. And obviously that's particularly what we're seeing with the Vanguard. And obviously that, you know, so I think that was actually quite a good way to introduce the Vanguard. And obviously, I know obviously from a model perspective, they had to find a way to integrate them. But I think from a lore perspective, it seems quite plausible. You know, it does actually, it didn't feel like, that just sounds silly.
In some ways, they've got the two generations of Primaris, you know, the guys that came out of stasis on Mars and the ones trained by the chapters. And that echoes the Horus Heresy in a bit, because you had these chapters initially all from Earth, and then they find the Primarchs, and then they're gradually replaced by Marines taken from, you know, those planets, trained the way the Primarch decided, kind of thing. So you have like the stasis. Some of the stasis born are still around, like Felix.
Yeah.
And he. So you can imagine, like with the Dark Angels, they probably wouldn't trust the guys that joined them from Mars, but they might trust the ones that they trained themselves a bit more.
Yeah.
Well, we used to see that when we spoke about the Death Guard, didn't we? In like the Buried Dagger, and obviously the pre-Nurgle side of things, where obviously you had that like the Terran born, and then obviously the Barbarous born Marines, and there was always that animosity between the sides. And I mean, obviously you're not seeing that with the Primaris, but yeah, that's actually a good way to look at it. They are in like different generations, and obviously the initial generations, the ones that, like I said, come out of stasis, Mars born, and like I said, they're very you know, I suppose a bit more restricted in, you know, and I suppose in initially in their thinking anyway, and obviously the way they display tactics, whereas obviously these new, you know, the second generation of Primaris, the next wave of them is more flexible, they're more experienced, and you know, they can now fit roles, as opposed to just, because obviously initially they were just bodies, weren't they, really? They're fit, you know, when the Primaris would come out, it's almost like, you know, Primaris for everyone. It's like throwing lots of sweets out to everyone. It's like, here you go, you have some. Whereas now, you know, now that they're not literally, but obviously all the chapters that needed fulfilling, you know, like obviously, like for example, Blood Angels at the end of Devastation of Baal because they got an ass kicking. Obviously, as you know, in the Great Work, for example, you see it with the size of the Emperor and things and chapters like that. And obviously, like you said, we've now seen whole Primaris chapters, which is also very exciting as well. Is that now they're now the norm for all the different chapters. And obviously, it does highlight it here in the Codex that obviously initially. You know, some particular chapters, obviously, primarily like ones like Dark Angels and their secrets upon secrets and their special handshakes and such like, they're obviously very wary of Primaris coming in. I'll direct this at Dan first. Do you feel that now the chapters are starting to warm to Primaris or do you think it still depends on a chapter by chapter basis?
I think generally they have done. A few exceptions will still exist, obviously. Mm. There'll be some chapters that just despise the Ultramarines or Gilliman for whatever reason, and anything that he sends them is like an insult. There's chapters like the Dark Angels who are so secretive that maybe some Primaris Marines that they have after 100 years might be ready for a promotion into the higher kind of echelons of the Dark Angels. But I think ultimately... You know, the Dark Angels, they're not traitors, as much as the people like to joke about it. So I think they will bring him into the fold eventually, you know, fully.
Mm. Yeah. I think ultimately it does come down to they sort of have to, they have to envelop them really, because they're not really going away. What's your thoughts on it, Cameron?
Yeah, I think for chapters like the Dark Angels, it's less a matter of warming up or trust and more a matter of control. And part of the Indominus Crusade going around handing out Primaris Marines to everyone was also handing out the technology to make Primaris Marines to everyone. And so, like, sure, the Dark Angels won't trust someone Belisarius Cole cooked up in a test tube on Mars 10,000 years ago, but... If they handpick a candidate from the age of 5, you know, raise them as if they were a normal Marine, and then as they're grown up, stick 3 more organs in there. Yeah, he's a Dark Angel. Of course he can be trusted. Of course he can be part of the Inner Circle. Makes sense. So I think it's getting through the time span of the Indominus Crusade is important for those more like... reclusive, sort of taciturn chapters to quote-unquote warm up to Primaris Marines. It's more like them vetting and... gaining control of the processes of creating them and ensuring that they are safe effectively for that particular chapter. You know, Dark Angel's like, well, a Mars-born Primaris might be reporting back to Belisarius Cole. We don't know. He might not even know. He might be doing it in his sleep through hypnotherapy or something like that.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
But, you know, this guy we picked out of an orphanage on this scattered planet all the way out here, yeah, no, he's fine. We can vet them, make sure they're fully us, as opposed to, and again, it's that outside influence. Like, if Reboot Gilliman gives us all these Marines, sure, great, they've been running around with Gilliman for 100 years, they're obviously his people. These Primaris Marines now, those are ours, you know? Less so on the ones that have been, you know, handed over to the chapter, the ones that the chapter raised themselves, yeah, absolutely, they'll trust. Yeah. I'm not so sure maybe on the Space Wolves side of things, just because Space Wolves are weird in their sense of community. And, like, honestly, I think they would warm up more to people who've been like, yeah, I've been crusading for 100 years, love to join the club, happy to finally meet you all, as opposed to, you know, Oh, God, my brain stopped working for a second. as opposed to, hey, you know, your archaic, long-standing tradition of, you know, tossing people out into the snow after making them drink a cocktail of wolf DNA? Don't do that anymore. You don't need to do that anymore. These Primaris Marines don't need the Caitlys Helix and all that kind of stuff. You just let them be. And every Space Wolf Elder is like, excuse me? That's not how that works. They have to have it.
Yeah.
I think one thing that Dolores has spoken about is how the chapters have grown distant over the millennia. How, like, people, they just don't work well with each other anymore. I mean, some still do, obviously. Yeah. Ultramarines get along with people, whatever. The Imperial Fists do as well. But some more reclusive chapters don't really interact with many others. And one of the main goals of the Indominus Crusade was to create all these mixed squads, you know, like Space Wolves, yeah, and Dark Angels, yeah, and Blood Angels, yeah, and Ultramarines. So that ultimately, when these new Marines are sent to the chapters, there's going to be a greater sense of kind of brotherhood between the different chapters, which will improve the Imperium's ability to actually fight the enemy. If the forces don't trust each other or keep information from each other, that's not how you win a fight. So this is like Gilliman's long game, is to actually strengthen the bonds between the chapters.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Like old school Space Wolves and Dark Angels. There's literally a stratagem for, hey, we will fight together, but first I'm going to try and kill you.
Standard.
Yeah.
And we need more stuff like that. I think when they finally get around to doing the new books for the Dark Angels and the Blood Angels and whatnot, I think we need more really thematic abilities like that, because that's very, very cool.
I'd agree with that. And it also just highlights how spread out the Imperium and its, you know, saviors in the Space Marines, how spread out they are. Like you said, there's so many chapters in so many different areas. Then, like you said, there's chapters devoted to containing something in an area that no one knows about. You know, it's like there's whole chapters devoted to that, whereas there's obviously whole chapters doing, you know, massive amounts of work throughout the different parts of the Imperium. Do you think that now, obviously with Gilliman actually being around, as opposed to obviously being on stasis for a while, do you feel that now, obviously, that because he's around, that can mean that when the Primaris are being pushed upon them, that it's a bit more, I don't know, they can sort of accept it a bit more, in the sense that, obviously, you know, he wrote the Codex Astartes, you know, many years ago, and wasn't around to enforce it. Or I know that's obviously a debate in itself, in the sense that should you be taking it to the letter, or obviously just using it as guidelines, which obviously Gilliman has sort of clarified. It must be more believable that, or more understanding for the chapters, where Gilliman's there going, yes, here's some Primaris, you know, trust him. You know, I'm the only, you know, currently I'm the only living son of the Emperor out there at the moment, trying to pull this mess of an Imperium together, you know, and hence why you need to accept these. I think,
it's not just Gilliman, it's also the custodes, because he did meet with the Emperor. We don't know exactly what was said, but we know that when he came out of that room, he knew exactly what had to be done. So he must have received some sort of direction. We know that for a fact. And the fact that the custodes are speaking on his behalf, I'm not sure that any chapter could refuse the gift if the Adeptus Custodes themselves are the ones who deliver the news. You know, these are literally the Emperor's companions.
Yeah.
And if you are loyal to the Emperor, you can't ignore the Emperor's companions.
I would say there are a few fringe chapters, I would say, for whom Rabuk Gilliman showing up in person is probably a very bad thing. Like, I want to be a fly on the wall when Gilliman goes to visit the exorcists and be like, excuse me, you do what now? No, don't do that. Stop doing that.
There's also the Spears of the Emperor as well. I don't know if you guys have read the book.
Yes, that's good.
They're Ultramarine successors who have more in common culturally with the Space Wolves.
Yes.
And they don't even believe that Gilliman has come back. They think it's an imposter. And they're on the other side of the rift, so they actually don't believe it's even him.
Yeah.
So,
it's fascinating the way that... And again, it's believable. It feels like this is actually a legitimate situation where... it highlights how fractured the Imperium and, you know, and like I said, the Space Marines are, you know, because I think sometimes it's easy to think that, you know, that these super soldiers and chapters are, you know, they are highly efficient, but you think, you know, that they're obviously all in different areas doing their thing. But the reality is, you know, some don't talk to each other. Some don't even know that they exist, or, you know, some, like I said, like you said in the example of the Spears, they're descendants, but don't believe it's Gilliman. You know what I mean? Like, I suppose it's so easy to have this mindset that all Space Marine chapters are just playing things by the book, but and doing things you know, that in that sort of fashion, whereas reality is, yeah, a lot of them are, but a lot of them are really doing their own thing. They're so cut off from the rest of, you know, the society, you know, in a manner of speaking, that they end up forming, you know, again, with the spears, they end up with their own rituals, their own way of doing things that, you know, like I said, it's, you wouldn't even believe that they're descendants of the Ultramarines if you compare them to the Ultramarines themselves. They, you know, they seem so like so much chalk and cheese, but, you know, that's the reality of it. And that's obviously what happens in these situations. So, no, it is very interesting. I was going to mention the Rubicon, which is obviously, you know, is briefly mentioned in the Codex. And obviously, yeah. And obviously, you know, it makes an interesting point that ultimately that no one really truly knows who was the first to brave the Rubicon. And obviously each chapter has their own, you know, hearsay situation, which again is very 40K because obviously, you know, think most lore can be quite wishy-washy because obviously it depends on time and space and who said it and how it was written down and all that sort of situation. I thought that was quite interesting. But do you feel that sort of going forward, the Rubicon is almost going to become a bit of a formality, or do you think we're going to see it where like people actually do die from it? Cause it seems it's so far the rate has been very good.
Yeah. Like I feel it has to, I've made this point for, it really has to at some point, someone important has to go through it. And you know, at some point it's just not enough. Like, I mean, we know it's risky. Like, for example, oh my god, what's his name? Chapter Master with the Ultramarines, Marty Skarsgård. Yeah, my brain completely shorted out there. Like, he was dead for 20 minutes during the procedure, but he came back eventually. But like, Marty Skarsgård's pretty strong and comparatively, I mean, he's old, but he's in his prime relative to a lot of other characters that could be sent through the Rubicon.
He's one of the strongest, like, Marines.
Yeah.
Generally. Yeah. So if that's, you're exactly right. If he nearly died, then imagine if Chaplain Cassius was like an old man with half of his face.
Yeah.
Missing, you
know? Yeah. I imagine
if he attempted like, it, he probably won't be able to cross it.
Yeah, and that's what I want. I want someone to fail, and instead of Games Workshop going, okay, can't use this character anymore, put them in a dreadnought. Put them in a goddamn dreadnought. I want a Chaplain Cassius Chaplain Dreadnought, because then you can have a plastic Chaplain Dreadnought kit, which would be awesome.
Yeah,
and make it a Redemptor Chaplain Dreadnought, because everything's Primaris these days.
That's the
anyway.
Only way to do it. Like, I think that's the only way to do it, where it doesn't upset people. Is like, okay, he failed. Here's the Dreadnought variant. Congratulations, you got a call back to Dreadnought.
Yeah, exactly. It's still an upgrade. It's just not the kind of upgrade you were expecting.
No. Yeah, true.
No, the one thing I'll say is I thought when they released the first few supplements, I was sure they were just going to upgrade everyone. But then we've seen from the Imperial Fist and Salamanders, they've actually just given them new characters. And the old ones haven't crossed the Rubicon. So, I actually don't think that everyone will cross it, but I expect the most iconic characters in the setting, for example, Dante, Azrael.
Yeah.
These guys who have really, like, just bad old models. They're tiny. Like, Dante's, like, minuscule. He's invisible on the table. And, I think the guys who most need a model will probably get the Rubicon treatment. Obviously, also the most iconic ones. Whereas you look at the Vulcan model from the Salamanders, that's a good looking model. That's still a really cool unique kit. And then new character, I'm amazed to say, is even better looking. That new Primaris Salamanders is absolutely amazing. Absolutely. I think it will be a combination of they'll upgrade some of them and we'll just get some new characters as well.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it's win-win really, isn't it? Because it fundamentally on many sides, if like say for example Dante, which like I said I think is a very high chance of braving it, A, he's iconic, they want to keep him around, B, it gives him an excuse to upgrade his model, and C, it keeps him around for a longer, you know, like, you know, I know he doesn't want to be, I know he's like, please kill me, but he, you know, ultimately it keep from a lore perspective, it keeps him around, you know, because obviously the further characters are sort of not in the limelight, or, you know, their model is deteriorating, so to speak, from an age perspective, there's a higher chance of them sort of just, you know, getting lost into time, basically. So,
And I would say for Blood Angels specifically, Dante and Mephiston are the only two characters that really, really need an upgrade. Like Lamartes and, what's the other guy? Astaroth. They both look great still. Those are both awesome models still. And
Mephiston is a very, very cool looking model.
Oh, yeah. Astaroth's incredible. But yeah, no, like Mephiston, super old, super weird looking. Dante, super tiny, definitely need an upgrade. But like, I feel for Dante specifically, the whole thing is like, he can't die until whatever Sanguinius needs him for is done. Put him in a dreadnought. He will last forever. He's already lasted so long. Oh, but it'll be so good. I've iterated this point time and time again. Forgeworld is making a jump pack contempt to dreadnought. Come on. You can't tell me you can't put Dante in that.
I think Mephiston will be a prime candidate for the treatment as well, because he's already kind of like a marine plus one, some sort of weird, whatever he is.
Yeah.
I think if he, I don't know if he even can do it. I mean, I expect he will, because his model's one of the ones that definitely needs an update. I think because obviously the Blood Angels can't get their Primarch back. Unless you, I guess they could, but you could make Mephiston into something almost equivalent to a Primarch if he's upgraded. If he just goes for one more upgrade, I mean, his stat line is already impressive enough. So,
yeah, that's fair.
Cool. Right, let's move on to the chapters. I think so. Like I said earlier, obviously, a lot of the successor chapters are actually quite interesting. I mean, before we get into those, is there anything of the main, you know, was it the main six that get mentioned? Is there anything of note that for either of you two?
Not really.
No.
I think from the ones in the main codex, you mentioned like the lore of the Iron Hands. I don't particularly like the Iron Hands. I think they've, I don't know if they've ignored or forgotten the lesson that Ferris Manus tried to teach them. You know, one of the things he said in the Heresy was that, you know, it's not just the flesh isn't weak. You know, that's, you know, they shouldn't just focus on the machine ahead of the body. He felt that they will become too inhuman if they went down this path. And it's something they seem to have kind of completely ignored. And it's hard to say what the real culture is now of the Iron Hands. Is it what it was meant to be, or is it what it became and has been for thousands of years? So it's hard to say what the real one is.
That's a good point.
But yeah, it's great. This is why these supplements are so good, I think. The more chapters they flesh out, I think, the better.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because I mean, that's the key thing of the Codex, isn't it? Like we said earlier, ultimately, it's giving an overview of Space Marines in general. And obviously, because there's so many big main chapters, there's so many successor chapters, there's only so much they can fit in. Otherwise, this would literally be thousands of pages long. And as lovely as that would be, it's not practical on many reasons. Is there anything for you, Cameron, out of the main ones?
Out of the main ones, there's nothing crazy really that stands out to me that, you know, I didn't already know. Like, there's the cool stuff, like Salamanders Forever. Salamanders are great. I love them. But it's nothing new as far as I'm concerned. And there's nothing crazy out there. Like, the chapters that are still in decline from the Days of the Heresy are still in decline from the Days of the Heresy. The chapters that are doing great are still doing great. The Imperial Fists continue their campaign of adopting every potential, like, weird founding chapter into their ranks. It's like, yeah, no, these guys, the Sons of the Phoenix, yeah, no, they're Imperial Fists. Come on, get over here.
Yeah.
Go stand in the line with everyone else. You're fine.
those silver-haired pretty boys over there who literally paint the battle as they're fighting it. They're definitely imperialists.
Yeah, definitely. It's such an imperial fist thing to do. I think, like you two, I agree. I think that there wasn't anything massive that you know, realistically people wouldn't already know, I think. I thought it was quite good that they obviously mentioned, obviously, what happened with Shrike being the new chapter master for the Raven Guard, because obviously it makes a point of Corvin Savarax being killed by the Tau, which obviously I'm sure will anger people, like, no, Tau doing stuff again. Because obviously some people get quite angry at the Tau doing stuff and obviously not already being wiped out.
Yeah.
And they've killed a chapter master. So, yeah, it's good that they've obviously brought that up to speed with things, obviously now, obviously knowing he's got a new model and he's obviously been promoted as well. But, I think for the main ones, it is your pretty standard affair. Right, let's delve into the successor chapters. Okay, so because like I said, there is some very interesting ones in this, and we'll start obviously with the Ultramarine one. So you obviously got the, like, the White Consoles, the Aurora chapter, Genesis chapter, etc. Obviously, Dan, you know, being a Ultramarines guy, any of these that you find particularly interesting?
Well, what I find interesting is that the Nova Marines in particular are described as being almost identical to the Ultramarines. But we know from the novels, slight time, just not in the codex, we know from the novels that they're actually quite different. And they have these weird, like, training rituals where they put you in a VR environment and you're kind of supposed to, like, feel like you're in some, what is it, like, wet mountain range? Or I can't quite recollect it. So the one Ultramarine who joined the Nova Marines in the novels was, like, you know, he didn't really fit in at all. And that's supposed to be the chapter which is the closest to the original in terms of how they operate. And I found that very, very interesting. But they've got so many that have completely diverged from the teaching, not the teaching, but the culture of the Ultramarines. So I think what's important is you can pick any founding chapter and basically design any kind of chapter that you like, and you will be able to justify it within the universe of 40K.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, but also, and it, I think it highlights again, you with most of these successes, obviously you can see where they get their sort of, you know, I suppose the parental sort of genes that come through, but also how massively they deviate from it. Because, like I said, you know, using the example of the Nova Marines, you're right, actually, because, you know, they're not as exact copies of the Ultramarines as the Codex is sort of, you know, leading us to believe. But then, you know, you've got the Silver Skulls, who are all about, you know, about portents and things like that, which, again, is not a very particularly Ultramarine way of things.
You've got the Howling Griffins, for example, which is all about battle tanks. There's one which is all about, like, they're depressed, and it's all about death.
Yeah.
It's great, yeah. I mean, I suppose because the Ultramarines have so many successes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
you'll be able to fill, like, any kind of niche of like, cultural identity just from their successes. Whereas they have successes which are more similar to, you know, to Blood Angels or to Iron Hands, in fact, so.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and it's I think it's fascinating. Some of them, I mean, like the Libertors, for example. They sort of let their foes' blood and dedicate it to the Primarch and the Emperor. I mean, again, you know, that's not something you would associate with an Ultramarine successor.
Germans don't want to see that. It's like, no, stop,
you know. You know. It's, you know, you'd expect it a bit more like the Howling Griffins, for example. You know, the Howling Griffins, one of my personal favourite chapters, that, you know, they're just, you know, they just do things, but, you know, they've got their own things, but ultimately, they're just a damn good chapter that just, you know, a wholehearted, you know, good for the whole family type chapter, you know. And then, like I said, you got the ones that are sort of, you know, like I said earlier, like the Silver Templars, who, you know, will get very upset if they lose their weapon. They actually, like, connect with their guns and their swords. And I think in some cases it can be a tank or anything. Like, I think that's a great thing, actually. Yeah. It can be a spacecraft. they can adhere, you know, can, you know, revere a spacecraft so much, you know, they lose it, and then they go into a, like, a sense of mourning. It's absolutely fascinating. Was there any for you, Cameron? I was going to say.
There are lots of the Ultramarines, good Ultramarines, I mean, successes. Yeah. My personal choice is Sons of Aura, simply for the fact that they are just perfect Ultramarine successes. They're, you know, exceptional in every way. They strive to be the very best and everything. There's just one thing. No one knows who the hell Aura was.
Yes.
They're like, we heard he was a really good Ultramarine, but there's literally no record of his name anywhere on the crag. But we'll still strive to be the very best guys.
His name is in the library somewhere, but like what he actually did is like been weathered away. Mm. So the tablet doesn't actually tell you why he's famous.
Yeah, I want there to be a reveal for this one day, and the twist to be, you know, it was like an initial Chapter Master's favorite serf or something.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, we're named after a mortal. He did fantastic work, though, so it's good enough.
Yeah, he's exceptionally good at sewing things. And it's like, so are we looking forward to seeing the Sons of Cameron at some point?
Oh, yeah, totally.
He's a really great guy, that Cameron.
Oh, God, I don't think I could do that.
Oh, no, it's awesome. And from memory, wasn't it the Fulminators? I swear they're the ones from that Robbie McNiven book.
Yes, I think you're right.
Sons of Ajax book.
Yeah. They might be. They're one of the new chapters. They're exclusively Primaris. Mm. I think they were made during the Indomitus founding.
They're
Frankenstein Marines because they were named after the lightning storms that got worse when their chapter was being created.
Yeah.
Which is pretty great, actually.
That's cool. Okay, so we'll move on to the Imperial Fist successors. Obviously you've got, you know, the very famous ones like the Black Templars and the Crimson Fists, probably, and obviously like we've mentioned, the Sons of the Phoenix, the definitely not Emperor's Children, successors. But I think most of these were pretty standard. To be fair, I don't think any particularly of these. Well, to me anyway, didn't overly stand out compared to what we already know.
I mean, I would say the Subjugators are a bit more brutal than the rest of the Fist successors. Like, several times they've liberated an Imperial world by just killing everyone on the planet one by one. Like, the population reduced to zero, but hey, it's our world again, guys. It's all good.
Is there any for you, Dan, that stand out particularly?
No, I think this is the Phoenix probably stand out the most to me, aside from, obviously, the Imperial Fists are quite lucky. They've got some really well-defined successors who've been quite well-supported in the past, the Crimson Fists and the Black Templars.
It's not
really common to see successor chapters even get like model support of any kind. I mean, I know it's been a while since I actually got new kits, but you can buy a Crimson Fist character, you know, which is very, very cool.
Yeah.
So I think, they've been quite lucky with their successors. And there's plenty there to look into. And like the Ultramarines, some of them are very, very different from what the Imperial Fists are. And it even makes the question, you know, are the Sons of the Phoenix, are they actually Imperial Fists? Are the Silver Skulls actually Ultramarines, or are they Iron Warriors? Because, you know, as we know, there was a contingent of Iron Warriors who were helping Ginnaman during the Heresy. And it's possible that the Silver Skulls are actually made from their gene seed. So there's all these fascinating little bits in the books if you delve deeper in. But I think they're very much the same. You know, there's lots of variety, the popular chapters.
There is. I mean, I suppose it gives a lot of room for us as hobbyists that want to actually, you know, do your own chapter that, like, realistically, this could, you know, you could have a chapter in mind. They could be successor of, you know, obviously another chapter. But ultimately, if you want them to be where, you know, at the end of the day, they stand on one leg for 10 minutes because that's what they do, you know, you can justify it almost. The where they come from is literally just where they come from. It doesn't define them per se. And I think it just gives you, you know, plenty of room. But like I said, also sometimes when I look at some of these successes, I think I actually forget they come under the chapter that they do. You think, oh, really? They actually connect, you know, there's not always an obvious connection, which is, again, you know, because of time as well, because obviously a lot of these chapters have been around for thousands of years, and obviously they obviously morph and obviously evolve depending on what obviously part of the Imperium they're in, for example. So if we move on to the White Scars ones, the one that made me quite amused was the Rampages. So the Rampages, second founding one of the White Scars. Yeah, obviously, great. You know, there's no mucking around. You know what they like to do, and it's the fact that they do facial scarring. You know, that's their that's their thing. You know, and they and then they take the, you know, they do rituals. They take the mud, the blood, and then they mix it with their drinks. Again, you can understand that being a white scar thing. Again, it's on borderline's blood angel thing to do, but you know, they're obviously one of the, you know, one of those successor chapters. So, any others that stand out?
I don't know. I don't think I know enough about the white scars. I mean, I know about the white scars themselves, but
that's fair.
I'm not sure. I'm super familiar with their successes.
Fair enough. I'm a big fan. What
you just pointed out is probably the most.
I'm a fan of the Dark Hunters just because they were founded and their very first mission was, hey, go kill this Warlord Titan as a chapter. It's like, and they because they've been psychologically scarred through the generations by this to the point where they really mistrust machinery as a whole, and they often get in fights with Mars because it's like, stop sending new technology. We want a rhino. We want a bike. We want nothing else.
Yeah.
No machine spirits.
No, thank you. That was really cool. You've also got the Mantis Warriors. Now they're quite interesting because
that's an iconic chapter.
They've obviously there's not many of them left because obviously they, you know, during obviously the Badab War, they sided with the Astral Claws. And obviously, what's I think is really cool is that because obviously they've sort of been forgiven as such for it, that they've been sent on like a century-long crusade as their punishment to do that. And obviously, I think that's, really cool. I'll be honest, though, they do look like a successor chapter that was made by like a five-year-old. Like the Mantis Warriors, and like this, have a little mantis on the shoulder pads. It's quite amusing. chapter, but really cool. Moving on to the Raven Guard ones. Again, I don't think there was any, like I said, they don't have many, obviously a lot of them. There's some that we know about already in previous, like the Necropolis Hawks. Obviously they are mentioned in Vigilus, if you anyone remember. The raptors are quite big as well. I'm trying to think what else we got here. You got the Knights of the Raven. They're sort of quite mysterious. They talk in tongues, you know, to each other. Oh, so they've got their own sort of battle. Yeah, they've got their own battle talk, basically. So they're a bit like, almost like the Sisters of Silence, where they've got their own thing, but they sort of, you know, but obviously talk in a different language. It's just quite interesting. And then I think that's it. Oh, yeah, you got the Iron Ravens. They basically use their 10th company to build loads of intel. And then they'll basically bring in a load of troops, and it's called the Blade of Korax. That's like the technique. It's like a sword blow, not literally, but like metaphorically. Yeah. That's cool. That's quite cool.
I love the Iron Ravens because they look like almost like Captain America. Which is so different for, you know, Raven Guard successes. The fact that they actually, the way they fight has things in common with the Raven Guard. Like you mentioned, they actually build up intel ahead of the fight. You know, they do a bit of like recon work, but they look like Captain America with these like silver, blue, white, and red kind of like armor paint.
I hadn't even thought of that until you said, that's really cool. they're good. That's cool. I was going to say, let's move on to the salamanders. And let's pass on the salamanders. There aren't any.
I was actually a bit disappointed. We've not had the supplement yet, so they might actually give us some successes. I think it's actually possible because now that this Primaris Salamanders in Call says that he's stabilized the gene seed, might actually be possible to make successes with salamanders. I think if we finally get some, it will be very, very cool.
That's, I mean, like you said, perfect opportunity for them to do that. And
it will be, I feel like, they're actually getting a supplement book. It will be disappointing for them not to maybe give us some. Is an idea.
No, I totally agree with that. Let's move on to the Iron Hands. So they got a few, and again, they're more sort of some of the well-known ones, obviously like the Brazen Claws, but also you got the Sons of Medusa. They're quite interesting because obviously they're similar to the Iron Hands, but they're under suspicion because obviously they basically their companies seem to be built of like three different clans that like tend to push each other even harder. So they've got their own, again, that seems very Iron Hands thing to do. Like they've got their own sort of beef going on between each other and obviously on everyone else. I think that's about
I like the Iron Lords personally, just because their job is to encircle the Grendel Stars, which is where the Bargesi live, which are some awful, awful Xenos. And their job is not to wipe out these Xenos, but to protect them from High Fleet Kraken, because if the Tyranids got their hands on that, it'd be really bad. So like they know they can't wipe out the Bargesi themselves, because they're too strong for a single chapter to take on. So they're like, okay, we just got to kill any Tyranids that come near this star system and hope the Bargesi don't get curious and try to leave. Which is pretty great.
Yeah. I mean, it must be a really difficult situation for him as well.
That's a fascinating, like, lore tidbit. I really want to explore that. Like, I want to know what in the DNA of these creatures will make them so terrible. Because we know that, like, the Tyranids were steered into an Orc War, weren't they? By this Inquisitor. So, I mean, I think mixing Tyranids with Orcs, it can't get much worse than that, because the Orcs are so... they have this incredible, like, you know, half-plant, half-animal hybrids, which makes them so resilient and adaptable. So what is it about these particular aliens, which is, like, even more dangerous than the Orcs? You know, I'd love to know that.
Yeah, I mean, and hopefully we'll see, like I say, going back to the sort of the novel side of things.
Give us a book.
Guy, can you? You know, you're good at doing this. Or just bang us out a couple of novels, please.
Just a 500-page book, like in a week. Don't worry about it.
No, I was going to say, like, it's knowing we've seen it with obviously like Spears of the Emperor, and obviously with like the great work, you see it with obviously the size of the Emperor as well. I think they're realizing that there's a lot of room there to obviously press upon, that they can make a lot out of these, you know, smaller chapters, so to speak. You know, it doesn't always have to be the main ones that get in novels, you know, built around them, because often they, you know, because without being harsh to them, they've been around for so many years, a lot of these chapters, that people know what to expect with them. Whereas when you focus on a relatively, either a brand new chapter or one that's very under the radar, you can delve into these really, you know, very specific, you know, things that but can have a massive, you know, lore implication across the board potentially. And if we, like I said, we just finish up with the unknown foundings. Obviously, there's a few quite big names in this one as well. Obviously, like everyone's favourite magpies, the Blood Ravens. Well, they're shiny. I love that meme about them being thieves all the time. Which is clearly not the case. And obviously, you've got the everyone's favourite, the Exorcist. You know, Cameron's favourite chapter.
And they're great.
I know. And obviously it's quite funny because they show the mentors, who are quite a different chapter as well. They tend to work alone, and you know, it makes reference obviously that they're known sometimes to be of unusual size and strength.
Is the mentors are maybe prototype Primaris Marines sent out by Call to test out the weapons, because they use don't they like teach people how to fight, or they learn from people how to fight? Is that part of the lore?
Yeah, well, if you remember in Spear of the Emperor,
there was a mentor in that,
And obviously he had his own serfs helpers with him, and they were obviously always constantly analyzing data and sort of feeding it to him. So yeah, they're very methodical in that sort of sense. You know, it's all about data and then using that to, you know, it's almost very Tau like in some ways actually. You're right. Actually, there could be some actual sort of Primaris prototyping in that as well. And also the fact they work alone, it's almost like they, you know, in the case of the character in that particular novel, he is, apart from his serfs, he's literally by himself. You know, he's not with any of his other parts of the chapter. So, yeah, I mean, you could see them being sent on different missions, you know, almost again as an experiment of sorts as well. Yeah, I think there's more to that chapter than we've seen, to be honest.
Oh, they might. they might not even be aware of everything in their own chapter.
No, that's true.
I mean, like we saw, that guy was sent by himself. So they might operate in small groups, divided up. So there's lots to explore there.
Yeah.
The same with the Blood Ravens, I think. I know the Dawn of War chapter, GW hasn't really capitalized on them very much, I don't think. There's no real kind of stories about them. But one thing I would love to see, if they ever focus on them on the tabletop properly, like support them with rules and relics and whatnot, I would love for them to have a stratagem where they can basically pick out any relic from any chapter, and it's just like one that's just stolen or borrowed.
That'd be great.
So like, the goddess of Macrag, like this random.
Oh god!
Imagine.
Well, I mean, technically, what you can do is you can run them as a successor chapter, and because they're unknown, you can say, "Oh, today there'll be Ultramarine successors," and take Ultramarine special issue war gear.
Yeah,
but not relics, unfortunately.
I mean, they've highlighted some of the, obviously, the very, you know, some of these very well-known ones, obviously, like the Black Dragons, obviously got blades coming from their limbs, which has always been, because often they're the ones that often get mentioned when people ask, is there any sort of deformities in some of the chapters? And obviously they always get mentioned. Isn't there another one? It always seems to be Black Dragons, another one that has some weird, out of the norm deformity, and I can't remember which one it is. You've got the Star Dragons, who have sort of basically electrical scarring, not caused by electrics, but they scar themselves and then they put electric circuitry to make it glow like caged stars. That is so bizarre.
It's very cool.
Like, very cool, but I mean, that'd be a great painting thing to do.
Yeah. Everyone wears a helmet in that chapter because I don't want to try.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, definitely. They're definitely all scarred and look amazing underneath, but you'll never see it. My painting's not good enough. Cool. Okay. Right. Well, got a little bit of time left. So what we'll do is, I think we'll focus on the Vanguard stuff to sort of wrap this up, because obviously, I mean, as you'd imagine, the Codex is full about all the normal stuff that we've had for many years, your tactical marines, your chaplains, librarians, etc. But I still feel that, especially the Vanguard stuff, which obviously still relatively new, is worth obviously talking about. So, right, who should we start with? Let's have a think. So, obviously, let's start with the Eliminators, actually. So that's your basic sniper type marine. So obviously they basically use stripped down Phobos armor, which, like Cameron said earlier, obviously the Phobos is just a variation of obviously the Primaris armor, which I really like. I like the fact that it's almost interchangeable, you know, the fact that you can sort of strip it down, bulk it up, you know, but same with the Gravis armor as well. I love that. I think it makes sense. It's common sense that that's how they would do things. And also it sort of, I suppose it brings it all together, because obviously a lot of these ultimate marines, obviously, like we see with Chaos Marines, they're sort of using, you know, Mark III helmet with Mark IV body, a Mark VI glove, all that sort of situation. So yeah, the Eliminators are quite cool, because they basically use a Mark III Shrike pattern bolt sniper rifle, with obviously lots of sights. What do you think about Eliminators?
Model wise, fantastic. Rules wise, absolutely great. They can easily be included in any list. They offer some very, very good utility. If you have 9 of them against the right opponent, they could be crippling. There's loads of there's loads of combinations, specifically like Dark Eldar, where they have the Talos engines. They're like coming forward and they're supported by some characters behind them. You could just pick them off before they ever get to you. Against some chapters like the Iron Hands, who have like aura characters who really improve the durability of units. If you have if 9 of these guys can take a shot, especially with the right stratagems and the right chapter tactic, I mean, they could really swing the battle. So I think this is a great unit. I think probably some of the best infantry snipers in the game in general. They're very, very useful, and they've been used against me to great effect, and also really durable, like really, really durable as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They have a 1-up save in cover, and if you're Raven Guard, you're -1 to hit them as well. So yeah. They are, yeah, they're fantastic.
Bit nuts.
I think to be fair, they've been crying out for a sniper unit. No offense to scout sniper squads, you know, because it sort of felt like you've got these scout sniper squads, and then when they're, you know, sort of not, you know, full Marines, they sort of seem, that's, you know, the sniper side of things seems to go out the window, really.
Yeah, that really useful weapon that we all love. Yeah, let's never use it again. It's like,
yeah, exactly. It just doesn't make any sense. You know, it's. It's, and I like the fact they got the similar to like the special ammo that you see like with like the Death Watch and such, like they got like hyper frag and executioner and mortise, you know, you got all these sort of different ammunition.
I just wish, this must be a balanced decision, I wish you could take him in a big squad. Like, I would love to run just so 10 cool. snipers in one unit. And I think it's a decision based on the rules, because there's that psychic power you can use with the Phobos Librarian, which you can cast it on a Phobos unit, and they basically can't be an enemy target unless they're the closest unit.
Oh god, yeah, that'd be
so
awesome.
So you can imagine 10 snipers that you can't shoot back at, and they're just picking off your character one after another. That would be brutal, yeah. So, and you could also do it with 10 of the last fusils as well. So you could have 10 lasers, like basically last cannon shots, and you can't shoot back at this unit.
Yeah.
So that would be rough. Very, very powerful. That's probably why they've done it.
Yeah.
I always put it down to balance. Yeah. Cool. Well, we got the suppressors as well. So obviously these are still one of the most baffling units to me. I always find these are, because they basically, these are ones that obviously have a mix of like Phobos and Gravis armor. These are the ones with the big jump packs and the accelerator auto cannons as well. And obviously enter the battle with a grav shoot or obviously a jump pack to obviously suppress it, such like, hence the name. I mean, from a like in the game, are they actually, because I've never used them or anything like that, are they any good in the game?
With the Iron Hands, they're very good. So
yeah,
if you're Iron Hands, because they have heavy weapons, so you can fly around without any penalty to shoot, and you get +1 on the AP, so it's AP -2, and they reroll ones naturally as well. So for 92 points, I think it is, you have basically a squad of three guys zooming around, firing six... Is it six shots? Yeah. Firing six, strength 7, AP -2, 2 damage shots. Or is it AP -3?
I'm checking right now.
Specifically...
Suppressor, there we go. It's AP -2 base, so it'd be AP -3.
Yeah, yeah, so with Iron Hands, so these guys will be flying around, so 12-inch movement, no penalty to shoot when they move, rerolling ones, strength 7, AP -3, 2 damage flat. That is
nice.
And any unit you shoot can't overwatch as well. So, specifically with Iron Hands, these guys are very good, very, very good.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
It's very good, actually.
And because of their movement and because they fly, you can literally deploy them when the game starts out of line of sight, far away. They've got long range. So it's with the movement, it's a 60-inch range as well with the guns.
Yeah.
So they're very easy to keep them alive. And, you know, they come out when you want them to. And they start, they bring the pain. It's very, very good.
Yes. Bring that pain. Cool. So then we got the infiltrators. Again, these are in Phobos armor, rocking smoke grenades, marksman bolt carbines. They basically use the Omni Scrambler, which is basically a tool that they use to wreck enemy comms. And obviously, they're all built around survival skills. And this is the unit that you see with the Helix Adepts. These are the ones, which is like a, I don't know, an apothecary light. They're sort of like a cut-down apothecary with a helix gauntlet. So, that, you know, they can do the stuff. They can help heal, and obviously they can take the gene seed, you know, from their fallen comrades and such like. But obviously I like where the lore works with these, that the fact that because they're often cut off from the rest of the, you know, the army, depending obviously on their mission, hence why they've got an apothecary of sorts, or, you know, a cut down one with them, just in case they're out in the field for a long time and there's no apothecary around to heal them. I like that. That makes a lot of sense. Are they used particularly in the game much these days?
If you're making a list to take to a tournament, or a list to take on the general, like any random army you might face, I basically wouldn't leave. I wouldn't leave the house without at least two units of these guys in my list.
Oh wow! Okay.
Fair.
They have their Omni Scrambler rule that they have means that nothing can arrive within 12 inches of these guys. And what's very important about this rule is that it also works against Gene Stealer cults who infiltrate close to you, and against any psychic power. For example, any ability which removes you from the table and then places you back down. So, for example, orcs use the jump to teleport like a squad of 30 boys next to you and then charge. These guys would stop them from arriving within 12 inches. So, so they are actually very, very good. One of the best troop choices in the game. Just very expensive. So you have to...
Yeah.
It's 220 points for two squads of five. So they are very expensive. Okay. But the utility is amazing.
Yeah, and I believe they automatically wound on sixes to hit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so
So if you're
if you use Imperial Fist, as we know, they get an extra hit on a six. So if you have like three big squads of these guys, that's gonna be 60 shots. So any six you roll is two automatic wounds.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
That's a big deal.
So yeah, they can actually. So you can use like just big squads of these guys to just like pick away at anything, Imperial Knights, battle tanks. Because if you're firing 60 shots, as you know, if you stand still, you get rapid fire at full range.
Yeah.
So if you're firing 60 shots, that's got to be a lot. That's got to be 12, on average, 12 to 18 automatic wounds.
Yeah. And if you're in a tactical doctrine, there's an extra minus one AP.
That's right.
On top of there as well. So good Vanguard units.
So like randomly, like these like random troop guys with just like small carbines are actually can be very damaging, but the utility they offer is incredible. Yeah.
Nice. Right, what's next in the Vanguard, or, well, the newer stuff? We've got to talk about everyone's gunslinging dreadnought hybrid. I know that obviously people have got mixed views on the Invicta, so basically the Invicta is like a stripped-down Redemptor. Key thing, obviously, knowing that it's got a live, you know, Phobos armored pilot as opposed to someone that's living off it. What I like about, again, from the background with them is the fact that the pilots are chosen purely on their sort of use of independence and protection of others. So basically, if they're seen to be always, you know, helping their comrades and protecting them, then there's a good chance they'll be put forward to be an Invicta. And obviously then they're given the authority to basically, you know, use this equipment, the Invicta, best they see, you know, see fit, and obviously use for different roles. One I like, it mentions urban monster hunt. I feel like that needs to be a thing somewhere. Like there needs to be
that sounds like a very that's a great use for them, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So that sentence justifies them completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds really cool. And obviously their main role is to support the Vanguard, so they're armed like basically a twinned iron hail autocannon or a compact incendium cannon. So basically obviously that sort of rounds, and obviously their root and tooting sidearm heavy bolter, which is so 40k.
Oh yeah.
How are they on the tabletop?
Good. Very good, actually, because they can deploy anywhere. So you can imagine when you deploy, you can immediately pressure your opponent.
Yeah.
So if you deploy like three of these, you know, 12 inches away from the opponent, he has to, that is the first unit he has to deal with in that game. So in a way you're dictating what your opponent is shooting at. And if you go first, I mean, you can do serious damage with these guys because they have five attacks on the charge, doing three damage each, and you can even make one of them fight twice. So they are an effective unit. They require finesse play because they're not particularly hard to destroy. So imagine if you get seized on, if you can't redeploy them, you might lose a lot of points. But the saving grace is they're actually quite cheap. So three of these will be less than 400 points.
Okay, Oh, that's not bad, actually. No. Yeah. Okay.
It's pretty good.
So if you think about it, if you compare it to a tank, you know, what are you getting? You're getting... the 13 wounds, aren't they? So you're getting 39 wounds for 400 points. A toughness 6.
It's not bad.
What a free save. So when you think of it that way, suddenly, well, that's not bad at all.
No. No, not when you put it like that. And obviously... In recent times, we also saw their new, well, I suppose their version of the Primaris Rhino as well, which is the, it's the, what's it called? Impulsor, that's it. Sorry, these names do overlap a lot. which is sort of like, I suppose it's a, yeah, it is a Rhino hybrid, really, of sorts as well. I mean, I suppose are people taking those as well? Are they actually people finding use for those?
Well, it's not released yet, but
Sorry.
I can give you some theory crafting.
Yeah, it's not, is it? No. That makes sense.
I think it has some niche uses. I don't think it's going to be particularly popular because Marines specifically now have so many ways to deploy units all over the board without even needing a transport. So why do I even need a cheap transport? I can get around without any transport whatsoever. It does have niche uses. For example, one idea that's been knocking around is you put Tigarius in an Impulsor, and turn one the little tank flies forward 14 inches. Tigarius then gets out and runs, so that's got to be 9 plus D6.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, you can cast No Zone, which is an extra 6-inch bubble of removing invul saves. So on turn one, you can just like catapult your Psyker 35 inches forward and remove all the invul saves from the enemy's main units before you shoot them. So there's all these like little niche uses where you can use them on. And you can put hell blasters in an Impulsor, you know, like they come out, they shoot their guns. But for less points, you can buy Inceptors who can just arrive for free from reserve and have more shots. So, and you know, if you're playing Raven Guard or White Scars, you can infiltrate units or you can outflank units. So I think they have a use. They're very thematic, but you know, I don't feel the need to take them personally in my list. I'm not sure they would actually improve my army in any way, but they can be useful, yeah.
No, that's fair enough. No, that's understandable. And I think the other one that we've seen in recent times, I think this is the last one, which again, I don't think is out yet. Again, I get mixed up with these. The Incursor. Is Incursor out yet?
Yeah.
So obviously these are the aggressive ones with bolt carbines and Diminator class Auspexes, which is cool. It's like a slave machine, which basically calculates info for the Marine and means they can like see through walls and things like that. Which, well, that's just cool. There's no, you know. So I mean, that's the thing. I think because we better wrap this up now because of time. I think that the Vanguard is really, personally, I think is really given a big lift to the Marines. I don't mean just rules perspective. I mean, just overall, I feel like it given a lot more diversity. Cause I think obviously when we saw the initial Primaris stuff, like your Intercessors and Aggressors, and everyone's like, oh, okay. Yeah. No worries. That's cool. But not blown away by it. Whereas I think personally, these sort of covert, Marines and obviously all the variations are definitely giving them a bit more personality and obviously a bit more flexibility. Would you guys agree with that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think this release has been absolutely amazing. And what I predict is that we'll have one more big release in the future, which will be the Gravis-based stuff. So what Marines are lacking now, what Primaris specifically are lacking now, is just like tough, high wounds, long-range firepower infantry. That's really the only thing they need.
Yeah.
So... There was a rumor someone found the mention of a Hell Fury in the Codex, a unit which doesn't exist yet on the tabletop. So that's probably something that's going to come out in the future. Mm-hmm. I imagine like maybe a Gravis squad with Melters.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm predicting from the name. Or maybe it could be suppressors, but with melter guns instead of like autocannons, which makes sense as well. They come down from the sky and they like shoot some flame or something or fire.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think the range is nearly completed, just lacking a few things, but it's opened up so many new avenues of play. The new kits are, they look amazing. They play really good. And they feel like Marines should always have felt.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the vibe I'm getting from people. Yeah.
They are tough. Like, if you get shot at by a full squad of guardsmen, you probably won't even lose a single Marine. You know, which is really how it should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in the past, if you took 3 wounds, you lost 3 Marines. If you take 3 wounds now, you lose 1 Marine.
Yeah,
you know, with the primary, it's a big difference. Yeah, so yeah, I think they play great, they look great, and very tactical as well.
Yeah, that's definitely the vibe. I think we're getting from, you know, people that play consistently, unlike us. Yeah.
Make no mistake, this is a really, really powerful codex. So these units have great rules. They're pointed aggressively, and with the stratagems and warlord traits and chapter tactics. You know, if you pick a chapter that is geared towards one playstyle and you really capitalize on that playstyle with the specific units, you can make very, very powerful, multiple different powerful armies as well. I mean, everyone's talking about Iron Hands because they're like unkillable, but you can you can make like Raven Guard lists, which on turn one have already captured every single objective on the board and have assaulted 3 or 4 of your units before you've rolled any dice. Like that's something you can do. So it's a very strong codex.
Awesome. No, and like I said, I think you've hit it on the head. Really, it's definitely brought both, you know, from a lore and from a tabletop, it's definitely brought Space Marines back to the forefront, which is where they need to be. I mean, I know obviously people may have difference of opinion on that, but I think ultimately Marines, you know, they're the bread and butter of 40K. They, you know, they are the poster boys, but ultimately they need to be of a certain standard, I believe, because ultimately that's how people get into the hobby a lot of the time. Not always, but that's a vast majority. And, you know, they need to be like that. And the same with the Stormcast, obviously, in AOS as well. So, and again, I don't really get bored of talking about Space Marines in general. I think there's always, you know, the intricacies, like we were saying about their chapters, are always fascinating. And the fact that, you know, more weird and wonderful stuff will come in the future is always encouraging and always exciting as well. So, no, very much looking forward to seeing where things go from here. So, I think we'll wrap this up because I think because of time, we won't have a discussion topic on this episode just because we're not really going to be able to fit it in. And before we wrap up, a big thank you to you, Dan. As always, it's a pleasure having you here. It would make it a yearly occurrence if you want.
No, it's very fun. Like I said, I'm hoping to have more free time next year as well. So if you guys want me to drop by with some tactical talk, I'm more than happy to.
Yeah. That sounds good, actually. We'll hold you to that. I think we'll definitely.
Yeah. I do play the game. I love it. It's very, very good. And I'm just hoping to have some more time to play it more. In fact, that's my only thing.
Yeah. Yes. We get reminded that I think that's on our calendar every week, isn't it? Like, try to play games and then cross it off. Doesn't happen. Oh dear. And where can people like find you on the internet, or, you know, if they wanted to speak to you, where do you hang out as such?
I am on Twitter. Let me just double check what my Twitter name is. I literally can't remember. I think it's one sec.
I think I've got it from, if it's the same as last time, because I think I put it in the show notes when you appeared last on the show. Okay. Well, I'll, if that's the case, then I will, I'll link it on there on the show notes as well. And obviously, you know, you frequent a lot on Bolter and Chainsword, don't you?
Yes, I'm sure you'll come across me on the Bolter and Chainsword, also on Daka Daka. I'm a bit more of a trolley presence on that forum. I think it's just a great big hive of scum and villainy, and I think I've sunk to that level when I'm on there. So so apologies if I offend anyone.
Cool. Awesome. And Cameron, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at @knight_twitten. That's knight without a K. Not sure what I'm doing on Twitter right now. It's been a blur the last week or so.
No worries. And you can find me on Twitter as well at NinjaBadger7. Again, I'm not often on there because generally I'm on our podcast Twitter, which is at Realm and Ruin. So if you want to follow us, check us out on there. And so this will be the end of episode 38. Hope you've enjoyed it. As I said earlier, go check out the AOS Reminders interview that we had with Davis Ford. That's really interesting because, like I said, it should be out by now. And as always, we'll catch you on the next one. Bye.
Adios.
Ciao.